And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Laura Clausen from Daily Kos Labor going to be here talking about the Romney education and a whole bunch of other things that going on in the world of labor. Also, Joan Fitzgerald, President of America Votes, is going to be here talking about Michigan and Arizona and Santorum, how insane the Santorum campaign has been. And I look at what Romney said, I think it was yesterday, that he said, I'm not going to light my hair on fire. Basically saying the people who throw the flames, who throw out the most incendiary comments, are the ones that the radical base that he's trying to get a hold of gravitate towards insanity. And I think he's right on that frame. The more insane the radical right becomes, the more, I guess, it does kind of pump up that fringe of a base. Now, what does that mean for the entire party? I'm looking at, the number of people coming out to vote, down. And you would think with this being, if we buy what we're told, which is that everyone's mad at Obama and the country's in the wrong direction, that Republicans would be flocking to the polls to mandate, to give this to the Republicans some sort of a mandate. But the voting numbers are actually down, which is pretty remarkable to me if you believe what the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media is telling us. I don't buy it. I honestly don't. But the right needs to keep pumping that up so that they motivate at least the insane part of the party. So it'll be interesting to talk to Joan about that. Also, Dr. Jace Kondravi is going to be here, a professor at Slippery Rock University. She's going to be here talking about the massive cuts to higher education that Tom Corbett is proposing, what that's going to mean to her students and to the folks that she represents. She's a APSCUF chapter president there at Slippery Rock University. She represents the faculty members there. And what these massive cuts year after year, what it's going to mean to the public universities. And as I've been saying from the beginning, this is all by design. We're going to starve them. We're going to starve them. We're going to starve them. And eventually they just go private. Pretty simple. Or they collapse altogether and there is no more. Which, again, I think that's what the wealth class wants. And, they're using their puppets, the Republicans, to push it forward, and a couple of Democrats as well. It's just a damn shame what we're doing to higher ed. Also, Tim Sherrock going to be here, author of Spies for Hire. He's also a journalist who covers private intelligence operations and what goes on. They're going to talk about the WikiLeaks situation and all of the emails that have been gotten. There are some of them coming out. Some interesting stuff. What we're doing is we're privatizing our intelligence. We're privatizing the military. We're privatizing everything. I shouldn't even say privatizing. We're profitizing. We're making sure that the big corporate special interests are well taken care of. So it'll be interesting to talk to Tim about that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So yesterday when we were talking with Victoria Jones from Talk Radio News Service, she brought up this study basically saying what I think most people already know. The Romney types of the world, the wealth class, they're not like us. They're not like working people. They're not like people who struggle and fight to make ends meet. So there was this study done by the folks at the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Toronto, and it did some analysis of people's behavior. They had a number of experiments that, if you look at, you go, well, yeah, I can see how someone of means would think that they're above it. One of the experiments they did is they looked at people who drive like Mercedes or BMWs and, really pricey cars. And, they just basic observations of who broke more rules at a four-way intersection, who ran through the stop sign, who ran the light, whatever. And compared that to people who may have driven, more moderately priced cars, the beaters, for instance. And they found, obviously, that the people who drove the big expensive cars, they blew through the light more often, rolled through the stop signs more often, cut off pedestrians more often. And there's, a very rational explanation for that. The financial consequence of being caught for someone who's, you know, struggling to make the car payment, keep gas in the tank, is much greater than someone who's driving a Lexus or a BMW or one of these $80,000 cars. A $100 fine to someone driving a car that barely made it past inspection is a whole lot more devastating than it is to someone who can afford a Mercedes. So I can see that. But they went down to even the smallest little things. And they tried this game of chance, for instance. You roll the dice, and it's an honesty thing. Well, they're videotaping you, I guess. And it's an honesty thing. You say what number you rolled. Well, they found that, you know, people of the higher socioeconomic status, and the higher you went up, the more likely it is you were to lie about just winning a small $50 prize. You would think that someone who $50 really means something. $50 could mean the difference between putting food on the table and going hungry for the day. They found that the people who $50 really wouldn't mean much to lied at a much higher rate. And that's one of those things that make you go, wow, that's pretty amazing. And as the guy who did the study, Paul Piff, said, he said it really shows the extreme lengths to which wealth and upper rank status in society can shape patterns of self-interest and being unethical. And I look at this and I go, well, yeah, no kidding. They've also seen other studies where people of these higher status were less likely to tell the truth in situations where they were hypothetically negotiating for jobs as the employer, where they knew the job was going to be eliminated in a couple of days. They have no problem lying. They have no problem cheating. They have no problem because the consequences aren't there. It's not something that's looked down on. And, you know, I've made this comment a couple of times, and my wife and I have talked about it sometimes, because, you know, we're raising our children to be, you know, honest, decent, you know, basically working class kids. And there's part of me that asks the question, am I doing them a disservice? And I brought it up to Victoria last night. Maybe there's a part of me that says, you know, in this society, maybe raising them to be little lying cheats is going to do better for them, for their, you know, their financial well-being. Now, me personally, I can't fathom doing that. But when you look around and you see the people who are getting ahead and who are able to, you know, to manipulate the system, that's what they basically are. You know, this idea, and the right keeps throwing this frame out there, well, you just need to work hard, get an education, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, the people who believe that are the kids who are saddled with hundreds of thousands of dollars in student debt and no job. So I'm looking at this and I'm going, you know, as I'm reading through this study, they even put out a jar of candy. They said, here's a jar of candy, and it's for these kids down the hall. So you can take a piece or two, but it's for the kids down the hall. Well, you know, the richest folks, the people at the top, they were the ones to take more candy than anyone else because they believe that they are self-entitled to whatever they want. And, you know, I didn't need this study to tell me this. We already know it. It's just another one of those things where you go, duh. But again, you know, it's right there. Now, Piff said, who has studied the impact of wealth on people's morality and charitable giving in the past, finding that rich people tend to give less to charity than poor people, said he was surprised to see them taking sweets from kids. He said, I was astonished. On average, people in the upper rank took two times as much candy as the other folks. And that's a pretty sizable difference. And you look at this and you go, well, that's that self-entitled, it's everything about me mentality. And what's interesting is what this study was able to find out is that, you know, people were able to train themselves to think more highly of themselves. So, you know, I've gotten a little bit better off. I've done a little bit better. So now I'm that wealth class, and I deserve more. And this is really something that the right has really, really glommed onto. This, and you listen to right-wing talk radio, and it's all of this real, this big masturbatory, you know, endeavor where we're just self-congratulatory, everybody slapping on each other on the back for doing basically nothing. But they're good at it, and it's fantastic. But it keeps those folks tend to be, and I would love to see someone actually do a study on that. anyone who identifies themselves as a lunatic that listens to the lint balls and the other ones, where they see themselves in the social strata and where they actually are. Because I seem to think that, you know, the folks who keep congratulating themselves for just doing the things that they should be doing, those are the folks who tend to look around and say, those people behind me are less than I am. And he said, look, you know, people can train themselves to think more highly of themselves. And that they, in turn, act with more greed and less ethical standards. And he says, you know, it's the status drives greed. And, yeah, of course. According to Piff, people with more money tend to look more positively on greed and less on family. So as I'm reading through this part of the study, he's going, the more money you have, the more status you have, the more resources, the less you need anyone else, because you're independent of everyone else. And this is what you keep hearing the Republicans, you know, pushing, this idea of, well, we don't need each other, we don't need society, we don't need community, all we need is self-reliance. And that means, you know, once you get to a certain amount of money, you don't need to rely on friends and family, you don't need any of that stuff. Because you're better than that. You're disconnected completely from that. Which is really ironic, because if you listen to Santorum running around, to him, well, it's all about the family. Nothing else matters except the one man, one woman, child thing. Which is kind of just, well, a whole other discussion for another day. But if you look at this study, which I found just to be another one of those things where you go, yeah, well, we already knew that, but thanks for the interesting article. He says that, you know, self-interest is more fundamental motive among society's elite. And the increase associated with greater wealth and status can promote wrongdoing. And he went on to say that what's really interesting is in societies where you have a massive inequality in the distribution of wealth, you have these patterns really, really standing out. So you look at here in the U.S., I mean, we are probably at one of the times in history where we've been as unequal as we've been in history. And yet the right keeps saying it's not enough. The right keeps saying we need more. The right keeps saying we need to crush those workers. Which is why I'm, you know, there are times where you go, there are people that you look up to and you say, there's somebody to emulate. There's this kid, Joseph Williams. He's a football player for the University of Virginia. He's one of 30 or 40 kids, one of 18 students at Virginia who are participating in a hunger strike. Why? Well, because the staff that works at the University of Virginia, most of them make minimum wage. And these kids are saying, you know what? We want to stand together. We want to make sure that folks have a decent opportunity. And you know why he's doing this? Evidently, according to him, when he was a kid, he's moved 30 times, lived in homeless shelters, lived in church basements, lived in homes of friends or family. He understands. You know, my question then becomes is, you know, a lot of these football players, especially when they get to the pros, why do they forget where they came from? I've met a lot of people over my lifespan who have started out like I did, growing up in a housing project, growing up in poverty, and have done fairly well. And a good number of them are the ones who turn back and go, you don't deserve any help. I'm better than you. That's scary stuff, folks. And the study kind of, you know, while we know what it is, does kind of highlight the fact that it can be learned. Anyway, 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Back after this with Laura Clausen from Daily Kos. Stick around.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The bottom line is that the oil companies want the price of gasoline and heating oil and jet fuel to increase. They're not happy making billions. You know, they want to make more money. That's what they're in business to do. They're not in business to help the driving public. They're not in business to help senior citizens on fixed income pay for heating oil. That's not what the oil companies are about.
United Steelworkers Local 10234 President Dennis Stefano. Big Oil is shutting down some East Coast refineries, wiping out about 3,000 jobs as they export gasoline produced in the U.S. and drive the prices of gasoline and home heating oil ever higher. The steelworkers are fighting these moves, demanding that the federal government get aggressive in reining in Big Oil in the public interest. If you're feeling the pain at the pump, Stefano urges you to call your congressman and the White House to demand that a leash be put on Big Oil.
I think it's important that anybody who spends money on gasoline or heating oil write their congressman, write the Energy Committee in Washington, D.C., write Jeff Bingaman from New Mexico. Ask him to conduct hearings and express your frustration. Write the White House and express your frustration at the price of gasoline and heating oil. The oil companies need to be reined in. We need to keep these refineries running in the United States. They're good middle-class paying jobs.
The USW says the restriction of gas and home heating oil supplies caused by these refinery shutdowns could endanger East Coast home heating oil supplies. The union says it could even be a national security issue should a disaster strike other refineries or pipelines. The art world was punked early Monday morning when a press release circulated purporting to be from the Whitney Museum of American Art. Jesse Russell reports.
The New York-based museum is hosting its biennial in March, and the fake release, accompanied by a fake website, said the organization would be returning sponsorship money from Sotheby's and Deutsche Bank. The release claimed the museum was unhappy with a decision by Sotheby's to lock out 43 union art handlers when their contract expired in July of 2011. While seeing record profits and giving a raise to their CEO. The fake press release said the break with Deutsche Bank was due to allegations of mortgage and investor fraud. The Whitney acknowledged on Monday that it did not send the press release. The press release followed a strongly worded statement from Occupy Wall Street calling for an end to the biennial. The statement said it upholds a system that benefits collectors, trustees, and corporations at the expense of art workers.
This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
In the end, Wall Street, with Obama, Duncan, Bloomberg, Walcott, and Goldstein as its agents, they once turned public education into private, profitable businesses. They hope to impose regime of managerial control over educators' working conditions and our students, our children's learning conditions.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Now, I still got that, you know, that thought in my head from the story yesterday in Florida. It's one of those things that just kind of makes you shake your head and go, yeah, okay, let's help out the school. Let's go rip some copper pipe out of an abandoned building, and let's rip the air conditioner out and all the wiring out. And, oh, by the way, we didn't really have permission to do that. Oops. That is truly a Rick Perry oops moment. Just amazing stuff. And what we're doing to education in this country is just an absolute shame. Just an absolute shame. I've got Laura Clausen from Daily Kos Labor on the line. Laura, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at the, you know, the stories across the country, education, as we're moving towards, as the opening said, towards industrializing it and really profitizing it.
Absolutely, and every part of education, from, you know, the food that kids eat in school to the books that they use to, you know, these charter schools that are funneling tens of thousands of dollars a month to management companies, as they're called, but that really just look like a way to funnel public education money into private hands.
Funnel by mean the word funnel, like steal? Because that's how I see it. It's not even funneling it. It's basically just stealing it. This is just a huge heist, a big ripoff of our tax dollars.
Yeah, and in this specific case in Florida, a ripoff of our tax dollars going to the Church of Scientology.
Yeah, there was a link between Scientology and the Nation of Islam, or do you think that was just the part to sensationalize the article?
You know, I have never heard that before, but
or does nothing surprise you at this point?
At this point, I think I'm in the nothing surprises me category, and you know, I guess you've got two sort of profit motivated semi-religious groups that maybe they would make common cause.
Yeah, you know, you look at it, and the sad reality is it's the kids who are going to get screwed in this. Because, you know, at the start of it, this new life technology school that they were, or new life force or whatever it was called, that they wanted to start sounded like a good idea. You're in a poverty-ridden area. We're going to have computers. We're going to teach kids technology and art and all these wonderful things. And it turns out that they've got like one computer, maybe two, that works half the time.
Right, and kids doing the work of school custodians, just like Newt Gingrich wanted.
Yeah, and that should make the Republicans happy. The part that would really make the Republicans happy, though, is that they were paying their teachers just $85 a day. And I'm going, you know, and right. Well, and they didn't even pay them half the time.
Exactly. $85 a day, which is less than substitute teachers make in a lot of places. And the teachers were having to carpool to work and buy school supplies for the kids. And they weren't even getting paid for months at a time.
And parents had to break into abandoned building and steal copper pipe.
Right.
I mean, that's just, how far backward do they want to take us?
Well, you know, I mean, this is really sort of a logical culmination of all of the other stories about Florida charter schools that have come out in the past year, from the Christian school that decided to become a charter school when its kids stopped having the money to pay their tuition, to, you know, the abysmal numbers of disabled kids and poor kids being served by Florida charter schools. So, I mean, it's like at a certain point, the only place you can go is run by Scientology and the Nation of Islam and ripping copper pipes out of abandoned buildings.
And, you know, the sad thing to me is none of these people are ever exposed. And in their, and I guess it shows how rich and how powerful this lobby is and how much money is behind this move to privatize education. Now, I look at this Michelle Ray, and you had written a piece about her, you know, her Teflon coat. I mean, even in the midst of cheating scandals and all the things that, all of the discredit that has come to her name, somehow she's still one of the icons of that movement.
Absolutely, and still drawing in tens of thousands of dollars, up to $50,000 to give a speech, plus expenses, and on stage with the Secretary of Education, even as the Department of Education is investigating whether cheating went on her watch.
Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest. One of my biggest concerns with Obama is Arne Duncan. Didn't like him from the beginning, like him even less as the days go on.
Absolutely, and, you know, I mean, it's, Diane Ravitch actually wrote a great piece where she asked if Obama is really following what Arne Duncan is doing, because when Obama talks about education, he says we don't want teachers teaching to the test, all this stuff that sounds right, and then everything Arne Duncan does pushes teachers to teach to the test.
Yeah, I've got kids in elementary school right now, and my daughter's fourth grade teacher said, look, you know, our days are really heavily segmented. I mean, it's, you've got to teach this for this a long time, this for this amount of time. There's no actual teaching going on. And as, you know, as I've said, it's, they're turning the profession of teaching, the art of teaching, into factory work, where these little vessels called children, you know, on the assembly line come by and you pour stuff into their heads. Well, all kids don't get information at the same pace and they don't learn the same way. I mean, this is why we need, well-trained, well-paid teachers to stay in the profession.
Exactly, and when teachers fight that kind of approach, they get accused of, you know, just being in it for themselves. The teachers' unions are just trying to protect teachers, and they don't care about kids. But who doesn't care about kids? I mean, that's the people who are trying to treat kids like assembly line products.
You know who really loves kids and who really cares about education? Our governor, Tom Corbett. He really loves kids, and he loves education. Otherwise, he wouldn't. Tough love. Remember that during the 80s and 90s, there was that movement of tough love. We're going to cut your funding. We're going to put 70 of you in a classroom because we love you that much.
Yeah, it's, you know, I know that I would feel very loved under those circumstances. And I would just really want to do my best if my governor was communicating to me that he cared that much.
Yeah, by slashing funding, 14,000 workers, teachers, and support staff gone from last year, and now this just insane amount of budget cuts that they're proposing this year. Just, again, he's the education governor. But the one thing that I think Republicans do stand, the position they do take firmly on education. They're all over the map when it comes to actually how to teach and what learning is all about, but they all hate teachers.
Exactly. You know, you've got Rick Santorum, who wants to take education out of federal control and out of state control, really, and just send it down to the local areas, and his ideal is really homeschooling. He hates teachers. Mitt Romney, who wants to put more federal control, more testing, he also hates teachers, so we can really all agree on that.
I mean, at least they have a position that they've clearly articulated. Because if you listen to Romney, no one knows where he's at half the day. I mean, he's all over the map every day. But his hatred of labor, his hatred of working people, that's to me pretty front and center. Not too long ago, he was in front of the ABC, the building people. The American
right.
the Association of Building Contractors or whatever it is. Basically tell them, you put me in, all your dreams will come true.
Exactly. I will give you your full agenda. Just tell me what it is, and I will promise it.
Prevailing wage, gone. Living wage, gone. Minimum wage, gone. Don't worry about that minimum wage. You can bring people in from Mexico and charge, pay them $1 an hour.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, think what's going to happen to safety regulations. As soon as they get those things, that's the next thing they're coming for.
Well, it's all regulations, Laura. Didn't you know? Regulations kill jobs.
Exactly.
You know, and I had a guy on my Facebook page the other day, which just kind of blew my mind. They were talking about safety regulations, and he said, well, if a couple workers die, so what? It's only a couple. Corporate profit, that's what's important. And it just shocks me that that's what the right thinks.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really for a bill that would force Republicans to just say what they're actually trying to do with each of these things that they file, you know. Like, I would much rather they be honest and say, yes, we are putting profit above people's lives, than that they just gut the regulations while pretending they still care.
Yeah, but you see, here's the thing, Laura. I think they're as honest as they can possibly be. I mean, right now, I mean, look at all of the stuff that they're proposing. All of the attacks on women, all of the attacks on workers. It's extremely blatant. Look at this thing down in Georgia, where they came up with Senate Bill 469 because the Occupy Atlanta folks and the Jobs with Justice folks went into the AT&T building to protest 740 jobs being cut. The next week, they've got a piece of legislation that makes that a felony.
Right. Yeah, and not just that's a felony, and then just normal picketing. Don't even go in the building. Normal picketing is punishable by fines of like $1,000 a day per person.
Yep. So what they're doing is what they've done to workers already, thanks to Taft-Hartley. Now you're going to have Shaft-Heartless, which is basically saying, you regular citizens, now we're going to treat you like workers. You're not going to be able to boycott anywhere else. No secondary boycotts, no picket lines, because we can get an injunction and throw you out.
Right, but Fred Phelps still gets to picket the funerals of dead soldiers.
Well, you know, and here's the thing. I'm, as much as I hate it, as deplorable as it is, he should have the right to do it, but those people should have the right to take his side and beat him with it. But that's a whole different argument for a different day. But again, you know, you look at these assaults, and I don't know how you can come up to any other conclusion that they just hate us.
Right.
Because we're not the 1%.
Right. And any right that they can think of to take from us, they will.
So let's talk about Romney right now. They're in Michigan. From what I'm hearing, too close to call at this point. May end up being a split state between Sanitarium and Romney. This whole mean over the auto industry. I mean, how is he able to try and play both sides of the fence on this?
Well, you know, it's Mitt Romney. He's comfortable saying two completely opposite things in the same sentence.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way of putting it. But if you look at it, and I understand the president gave a speech today about the auto industry to the auto workers union, basically rebutting Romney's claims. How'd that go?
He gave a really strong speech. You know, it's always heartening when Obama comes out and really speaks for working people and explicitly for their unions. He also got in some really nice digs at Romney at the fact that Romney does not know what he's talking about when he talks about how he would have dealt with the auto industry in late 2008, 2009.
And I think he doesn't know what he's talking about on a lot of things. I mean, this idea that he was a job creator is kind of one of those things where you go, well, one, if you were a job creator, let's look at the jobs you created. Basically, just above minimum wage jobs that really produce very little. And even then, when you look into the reality of it, he didn't really do much to help those. He wrote a check and then got out, right? Isn't that how, I mean, am I missing something here?
No, and the thing that he wants us to miss, of course, is all of the jobs that he destroyed. You know, we're supposed to count every job that ever got created at any company that he so much as looked at. But the ones where he actually was directly involved in cutting jobs, we're supposed to pretend those don't exist.
Well, it will be interesting to see what goes on here today. I'm hoping for a split. I'm really hoping that the primary for the Republicans goes on into April, so Pennsylvania matters. That would be nice.
Just the longer the better.
Absolutely. Laura Claussen, it's always great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
Laura Claussen, Daily Kos Labor. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around, right back.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Karl Rove, the supreme sleazemeister of negative political advertising, complained about a recent television ad. I was frankly offended by it. Wow, that's like a skunk saying some other critter stinks. What could possibly make an ad so offensive that Karl would gag? Hope, that's what. The sweet flower of optimism nauseates Karl. The ad was Chrysler's Super Bowl spot. Aired during halftime of the game, it featured Clint Eastwood in a darkened factory saying, "It's halftime in America, too. People are out of work and they're hurting," he said, "but revival is coming from the American people's can-do spirit. Detroit's showing us it can be done." "Our country can't be knocked out with one punch," Eastwood declared. "We get right back up again. Yeah, it's halftime, America, and our second half is about to begin." Rove hated Chrysler's upbeat message and went on Fox TV to lambast the 2008 bailout of America's auto industry, even though it was a success. Unable to stop himself from publicly stomping on one of the few flowers to bloom in our shattered economy, the sour and surly Karl even suggested the ad was a political favor from the industry to President Obama for providing rescue funds. I hate to interrupt Rove's nasty tantrum with a dose of reality, but the auto bailout was initiated not by Obama, but by George W. Bush, for whom Rove worked. And, in an embarrassing happenstance, on the very day that Karl was fulminating on Fox, Bush himself was expressing pride in helping save the industry, pointedly saying, "I'd do it again." This is Jim Hightower saying, "Rove is the one with a crass partisan agenda. He's now amassing a $100 million war chest to carpet bomb Obama with negative TV ads. So he's offended by any positive message about America's future. Rove is the sickness in today's politics."
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, the one thing that the Republicans do stand on, and we've been talking about it for some time, is this idea that they can use government against the people. And it's amazing to me that they buy into this, that voters buy into that they're the party of limited government, the party of smaller government, less intrusive government. How can you not look at newspaper every day, time and time, every day, day after day, and not see every attack on people by this party? And it's all, I don't know how you can look and say, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Maine, Tennessee, Alabama, all of these states across the country, all of these states that have Republican governors and Republican legislatures, all of these states basically doing the same thing in the same order with the same provisions, with the same language. I don't know how you can come to other than one conclusion, that this is a coordinated effort by a group or a handful of groups. Now, the American Legislative Exchange Council, they've been the ones given all the credit for it. A heavily funded, big outfit, you know, founded back in the early 70s, who've been pushing this stuff, who have been, you know, greasing the palms a little bit. So I don't know, you know, whether, no matter what it is, it's really just amazing to me that the Republicans haven't run away and said, you know what, you people who put these pieces of legislation up that you didn't write, you should go. So you look now, the latest one is this. This ultrasound thing. You know, Virginia had one. They've kind of backed away from the transvaginal thing since, you know, it's like rape. Saying, sorry, honey, if you want to have that abortion, we're gonna probe you. And we're going to probe you good. So there was obviously a backlash. People said, no, I don't think that's a good idea. So other states wanted to do it. Alabama, you know, they had one. Utah is said to be considering one. But in Utah, what they're saying is the physician who performs the abortion or qualified technician shall perform an obstetric ultrasound on the pregnant patient using whichever method the physician and patient agree is best for the circumstance. I would say the patient doesn't want it at all. What you're doing is you're forcing them to do it. And here in Pennsylvania, the insanity has come home to roost, thanks to State Representative Kathy Rapp. The Women's Right to Know Act, House Bill 1077, another one of these insane pieces of legislation that, you know, she cut and pasted from somewhere. Now, I don't know if it's going to have the transvaginal requirement in it. I don't know if this type of ultrasound is going to be the one that we in Pennsylvania decide has to be done. But who are these people? Who is this woman to think that she should have the ability or the gall to tell someone else what they have to do with their doctor? I mean, it's just mind-blowing to me. And at a time when we're talking about medical costs skyrocketing out of control, we're kicking 41,000 people off of adult basic last year, 150,000 kids off of the Medicaid program, we're now mandating more healthcare spending on something that is just plain stupid. But, Rick, the party of smaller government, they think it's a good idea. The party of less intrusive government. I mean, what could be more intrusive than I'm going to stop and think about it. What could be more intrusive than that? That is how they see the use of government. Now, heaven forbid you use government to make people's lives better. Minimum wage, you know, maximum hour laws, you know, you name it. Safety on the job. We can't use that. Those are job-killing regulations. But get inside somebody's bedroom, get inside someone's personal life. Well, we're all in favor of that. This birth control thing, this contraception thing that the right has just jumped onto. And why have they jumped onto it? Well, because it's divisive. And it's the shiny thing. You know why this? I'll tell you why I think the Women's Right to Know Act of 2012, put forth by this nitwit. You know why this is put out? This is cover for that crummy budget. This is cover for that immoral budget. That's what this is. It's all about covering up Tom Corbett's insane budget, the one that's gutting education. The one that's going after sick people and poor people and the elderly. Oh, yeah, more family values, people. We care. Especially about someone's uterus. So Kansas Governor Sam Brownback, or as I call him, Brokeback, he was on C-SPAN Monday morning. And, you know, a woman calls in and says, you know, I'm concerned what you guys are doing with contraception. And he says, you know, we're not denying women's rights. No, we're not doing that. He says, you know, Well, here it is.
If a woman then wants birth control, go work somewhere else.
Go work somewhere else. That's the. If you don't like what we're doing, go somewhere else. And immediately what I thought of this, well, what if I want to join a union? I mean, the radical right keeps telling me if I don't like the fact that there's no union, I should go somewhere else. And I keep telling them if they don't like the fact that there's a union here, they can go somewhere else. If they don't want to pay dues, they can go somewhere else. Oh, no, Rick, that's my person. That's my freedom. Well, what about these women? Do they not have some type of freedom? And I look at the family values people, the party of family values, going around the country and pushing their abstinence only. Utah, for instance, another one of the crazy states, saying, you know what? Either you teach abstinence or you teach nothing, because they're the party of dumb. They're the party of head in the sand. We don't want kids to know anything about their bodies. They're the party of repression. And you know what? It's fitting, in my opinion, that a Catholic would be the guy leading that. It is fitting that Santorum's that guy. Because I got to be honest with you, and I said this yesterday. I was at the post office, and as I was coming out the door, I happened to bump into someone, and we kind of simultaneously and immediately said, oh, I'm sorry. And I just looked at her and go, you're Catholic, right? And she laughed, and yeah, and we went on. Because we understood. Immediately, you understand. You're taught to be sorry for everything. You're repressed. You're sorry to be anything that happens. And my wife tells me this all the time. Anything that happens, oh, I'm sorry. Well, why are you sorry? You didn't do it. Just a conditioned response. Much like the rich kid who's been conditioned to think that everything should be his and the candy jar is all his and everything is all his, I'm conditioned as a child, beaten regularly as a young kid, to say I'm sorry, to be sorry for everything, which is why I don't send my kids to Catholic school. But the people, the family values people, you know, the ones who don't want people, workers to have rights. If you don't like it, if you don't like that your insurance doesn't offer contraception coverage, go somewhere else. So where does this end then? If you don't like the fact that it covers cancer treatment, you should go somewhere else? Where does this end? And I look at this story in North Carolina, you know, another one of those right-to-work states, one of those good, you got the right to work, well, the right to get fired, actually. One of these, you have the right states. Well, this woman has cancer, Donna Sotomayor. She took some family leave time from the River Bend Elementary School in Raleigh to get some chemotherapy. Six chemo treatments, 33 radiation treatments. She was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer in January of 2010. She has missed 6 weeks of work. So you look at this and you go, okay, well, family medical leave gives you 12, right? Oh, gee, she doesn't qualify because they don't have to. They don't have the mandatory number of workers there. So I guess she falls under that. Well, she was fired the other day because she's missed too much work and they need reliable employees. That's their word. She's never had a bad, never had a bad review. Never. Always done very well. They fired her. Why? Well, you know what? We just can't hold everyone's job indefinitely. Sometimes you just have to go on. And I started thinking about this woman who now doesn't have a job. And in a very short period of time, will not have health care. What does that mean for her future? We live in a no job, no insurance, you die world. What do you think the family values people are going to do? Do you think they'll come to her aid? Do you think the Republicans there in North Carolina will come and fight for her? I doubt it. I absolutely doubt it. Let's take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Drowning in crafted lies. Save you.
USA, average to advertise it fine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job, join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, how a team of astronomers made a better yardstick for measuring distances across space. Astronomer Fritz Benedict of the University of Texas and his team have directly measured distances to five variable stars called R.R. Lyrae stars.
Up until our work, though, we'd had no really good measure of the intrinsic brightness of this kind of star.
Benedict's team used a very precise instrument aboard the Hubble Space Telescope combined with an old technique for measuring star distances called stellar parallax.
And basically, parallax is very easy to understand. You just hold a finger up in front of your nose and open and shut your eyes and alternate. You watch your finger bounce back and forth against the background, and the further away your finger is, the less of a bounce back and forth there is.
Knowing the distances to R.R. Lyrae variable stars is important because these stars are one of the stepping stones used by astronomers to estimate distances across the universe.
So the work is basically the moral equivalent of someone handing you a yardstick and you don't know if it's 30 inches long or 40 inches long. Now we've handed you a yardstick that it's either 35 inches long or 37 inches long. That's a much better yardstick.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell.
Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, the Republicans have taken this aim at regulation. Any regulation is bad. Just horrible. They're just job killers, Rick. All those regulations are job killers. Regardless of what the facts are, they've got this, you know, they've got this talking point, and they're going to hammer on it. You know, I was watching the speeches last night on the House floor, and Republican after Republican, same rhetoric. It was like the stump speech for all of them. Job killing regulations. Oh, yeah, the economy's doing better. Wall Street's better than it's been, and as well as it was under the last Democrat. Things are going great, but it's those job killing regulations that are holding us back. We could be further ahead. And again, you know, no proof, no way of possibly coming to that proof. But it's still all they've got. It's all that's there. So you see the House Republicans in the Chamber of Commerce now, they're coming out against Dodd-Frank again. But specifically one little rule. This idea that we should be reining the banks in from risky trading. You know, basically saying, you know, we need that dividing line again. And the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, they've released their quarterly banking profile. And, of course, you know, as you probably know, the quarterly banking profile shows that what the Republicans are claiming regarding Dodd-Frank, not at all true. The release says that the FDIC insured commercial banks and saving institutions earned $26.3 billion in profit at the end of last year. That is up 23% over their
2010 numbers, making the fourth quarter of 2011 the most profitable period in the history of the industry since 2006. They're telling me that regulations are going to kill them. By having this dividing line in place, it's going to stop the profitability. It's just going to kill them. And what you've got is you've got all these banks now going, well, gee, how are we going to think of new ways to screw our customers? Because remember, you know, we had talked about some time, all of the number of people who have left the big two too big to fail banks. They've gone to smaller local banks or credit unions. I think it was, what, 5.4 million or something like that, some outrageous number, 10%, just some really outrageous number. So these big banks, they've got to figure out how to make money off of people even after they're leaving. So I guess that's the question. What do you do then? If you're one of these huge banks who's at the government trough, where do you go? Well, you continue at the government trough. And you look at what Logan Smith of the Pomento Public Record wrote about South Carolina's new idea of issuing their tax returns on prepaid debit cards. So no more checks from the state of South Carolina. No. That cost a couple of pennies. Now we're going to issue you debit cards. And my thought is, well, wouldn't a little piece of plastic and the whole process to get the money out, wouldn't that be more costly than just issuing a check? Just a thought. As you delve into this and as he looks at this, it turns out Bank of America has been contracted cost-free to the state to issue these debit cards. So the state's going, okay, well, this private for-profit bank has decided that they're going to do our work for us. They're going to do it for free. So that's a win-win. We're saving the taxpayers money. See how smart we are? Us smart privatizing Republican governors and politicians. See how smart we are? We've got the private interest doing our work for free. We're smart, aren't we? Yes, we're very smart. Here's the problem. Every withdrawal from the Bank of America debit card that happens at a non-Bank of America ATM, Bank of America is going to slap you with a $2.50 charge above and beyond whatever it is the bank that you went to charge. So if you went to a bank that raped you for $3, Bank of America is going to pop another $2.50 out of it. So you just $5.50 to get your money. So now and it just kind of makes you go, okay, now these debit cards that we're giving, now understand, on top of them, it's going to cost you $2.50. When you want to get your money directly from the bank, the first time it's free. But every time you withdraw money off of that card from then on, it's a $10 fee. And the other part of it is if you if you go out of the country, they're going to charge you 2% of every single transaction. And if you want to close your account, that's a $5 fee. They have figured out how to basically stick you in the behind and have your state help you do it, help them do it. And as the one woman says, this Susan Berkowitz, director of the Appleseed Legal Justice Center, as she said, you know, they're not nickel and diming people. They're $5 and $10 people. This is, you know, just a ripoff. But from the political aspect of this, they're going to be able to run out and say, see, we've saved the state money. We cut our expenses. We've cut spending. But who got stuck in this? Who got screwed? You did, the working people of South Carolina. That person who got $50 or $100 or $200 return, it's going to cost you $10 or $2.50 if you hit an ATM that isn't there. I mean, this is really kind of remarkable. And they're betting on you racking up the charges. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And then you hear them talk about job-killing regulations. Oh, they're killing us. I look at this story from West Virginia. Monsanto just agreed to a tentative settlement with the folks of Nitro, West Virginia. $100 million settlement. $100 million. And here's the thing. For about 75 years, between 1929 and 2004, this plant in Nitro, West Virginia, churned out herbicides and rubber products and chemicals that, you know, basically the Army used to, well, they made the Agent Orange to basically deforest most of Vietnam. The chemicals that they made there, well, of course, they didn't harm anyone, did they? Of course not. They find high rates of cancer, high rates of a whole bunch of different problems, basically caused this because they closed the plant, and now it's just a, well, it's just the community's problem. So you go $100,000, $100 million settlement, that's a pretty good thing. They're gonna do some testing of people. We're going to follow some folks, make sure that they get some sort of health care. You know, just a little bit. They set up $21 million for testing, $63 million for additional care. We're going to monitor some folks. So, you know, people are going to be well taken care of. $100 million, that's a lot of money, right? Monsanto last year, in 2010, profited $1.1 billion. So when I look at this and I go, you know, maybe the Republicans are right. Those job-killing regulations, killing the profitability of a company like Monsanto. And it only cost them $100 million for years of pollution, for years of lack of regulation that have destroyed and ruined that land. But then I ask the question, what about the lack of regulation? What about the life-killing lack of regulation, all the people who are suffering and dying because of it? I guess that doesn't play into it. I guess we really not all shouldn't be concerned about that. As long as you got a job, you're happy, right? When you're dead, you won't know it. And when you're dead, your family can then go sue in a multi-year suit to try and get a couple of pennies to avenge your death. I guess that's the way to go. Because the argument is, and the right makes the argument all the time, you know, companies, they don't want to be in bad position. They don't want to be sued, so they're going to do the right thing. I don't buy bridges and I don't buy BS, and that's what it basically is. Understand these companies, they understand one thing, the bottom line, the dollar amount, what it's going to cost them. And if you being killed by their product is cheaper than them fixing it, kiss your sweet behind goodbye. Quick break, right back after this.
As long as my two hands are fit to use, I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The bottom line is that the oil companies want the price of gasoline and heating oil and jet fuel to increase. They're not happy making billions. You know, they want to make more money. That's what they're in business to do. They're not in business to help the driving public. They're not in business to help senior citizens on fixed income pay for heating oil. That's not what the oil companies are about.
United Steelworkers Local 10234 President Dennis Stefano. Big Oil is shutting down some East Coast refineries, wiping out about 3,000 jobs as they export gasoline produced in the U.S. and drive the prices of gasoline and home heating oil ever higher. The steelworkers are fighting these moves, demanding that the federal government get aggressive in reining in Big Oil in the public interest. If you're feeling the pain at the pump, Stefano urges you to call your congressman and the White House to demand that a leash be put on Big Oil.
I think it's important that anybody who spends money on gasoline or heating oil write their congressman, write the Energy Committee in Washington, D.C., write Jeff Bingaman from New Mexico. Ask him to conduct hearings and express your frustration. Write the White House and express your frustration at the price of gasoline and heating oil. the oil companies need to be reined in. We need to keep these refineries running in the United States. They're good middle-class paying jobs.
USW says the restriction of gas and home heating oil supplies caused by these refinery shutdowns could endanger East Coast home heating oil supplies. The union says it could even be a national security issue should a disaster strike other refineries or pipelines. The art world was punked early Monday morning when a press release circulated purporting to be from the Whitney Museum of American Art. Jesse Russell reports.
The New York-based museum is hosting its biennial in March, and the fake release, accompanied by a fake website, said the organization would be returning sponsorship money from Sotheby's and Deutsche Bank. The release claimed the museum was unhappy with a decision by Sotheby's to lock out 43 union art handlers when their contract expired in July of 2011, while seeing record profits and giving a raise to their CEO. The fake press release said the break with Deutsche Bank was due to allegations of mortgage and investor fraud. The Whitney acknowledged on Monday that it did not send the press release. The press release followed a strongly worded statement from Occupy Wall Street calling for an end to the biennial. The statement said it upholds a system that benefits collectors, trustees, and corporations at the expense of art workers.
This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
I gotta tell you, I miss him. He was fun, you know, especially when he, whatever it was, whatever the dopey moments he had, whether he was drugged up because of his back problems or whatever it was, he was. Well, I'm gonna miss Rick Perry, but he tells us 2016 he may be back. So if the Republicans lose here in 2012, look what we've got to look forward to. 4 years of people running for president. Hasn't been bad enough that it's been almost 2 years now. It'll be four then. For me, it'll be great. But I think for the nation as a whole, I think we will tire of it quickly. But anyway, today in Michigan, the trees where they are just right. The Romney and Santorum people are going at it. That's why I've asked Joan Fitzgerald, president of America Votes, AmericaVotes.org, to come talk to us about what's going on there. Joan, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, you're very welcome. It is a very exciting day.
Oh, it's just beautiful. I mean, to talk about the state where the trees are just the right height. I'm not sure what that means, but according to Mitt Romney, the trees are just the right height there.
Mitt Romney has made some statements that are either totally out of context or just not understandable from a candidate running for president. You actually have to wonder, is the man overtired or is he so uncomfortable in his own skin that he has to find things that are inane to say because he's not sure what he stands for anymore?
Yeah, what's interesting to me is how hard it seems that he is working at trying to appear that he's like me, that he's just an average everyday guy. I got to be honest, I would have more respect for the guy if he said, look, I'm a rich guy. I have no idea what your life is like, but I'm going to try and make your life as good as mine. Vote for me, and I will work to do that, because I have no idea what it is that you little people toil with. I have no idea. I would respect that.
I think you're right, and I think a lot of people would respect that in that he actually was being true to himself. But some of the things that he's come out with, you know, referring to the salary he made from speaker's fees as not very much, of $374,000, that, you know, that was pocket change. You find that in your couch cushion. Really?
Yeah, I'd love to have his couch.
Yeah, well, we'll all stand outside and wait for him to throw out a piece of furniture and just go through it. It's just kind of amazing to me that he hasn't had, you know, some sort of help getting him to understand what regular American families are facing. Well, he either says it in a way that's condescending or in a way that is so unrelatable that people wonder what planet he's from.
Yeah, and at the end of it, it comes down to, for me, either he's hiring really bad people, which would question my, which question his ability to lead the nation, or he just doesn't care.
I think he's just he's been made into someone he's not to run this primary. He's been forced to the right and has embraced it. I mean, I'm not saying he didn't do it of his own free will, but now he doesn't even know who he is. He's, you know, he's making statements that are contrary to how he's acted, how he governed as a governor, and he's sort of between a rock and a hard place. He doesn't know who Mitt Romney is. So he makes these inane statements because that's basically all he can think of to say that's not controversial or doesn't refute who he formerly was.
Yeah, I think a couple of my favorite lines of his is he likes to fire people. I like firing people.
I like, and what I loved about that, I like to fire people who provide services to me. And he was talking about healthcare carriers. I would just like to get him, you know, in a room quietly and say, Mittens, let me tell you something. You can't fire your health insurer if you have a pre-existing condition. You're stuck with them.
Yep.
This is the problem. You can't fire these people.
Well, he can. Understand. He is he is of sufficient wealth that he doesn't need health insurance. He could pay out of pocket for whatever procedure he needs.
He could buy the hospital.
Exactly. I mean, so when you're in that kind of a world, and, you know, at the beginning of the program, talked about this study that just came out from Cal Berkeley and I think it was Vancouver, where they said, you know, rich people, they think that they're self-entitled and they'd steal candy from children and they're different.
Well, who was it? Who was the author who said the rich, they're not like you and me?
I don't remember, but they're not.
They're not. And everything can always be fixed by enough money. And, you know, frankly, that's kind of the career path he chose. It's interesting how he's trying to spin it, but I don't think he ever expected to have this prolonged haranguing, not only from the ultra-right wing, which he probably did expect, but from people like Gingrich taking this populist tone, and then Santorum pretending to embrace, you know, the middle class and working people. He's now getting it from both sides.
Yeah.
And he's just hanging on by a thread. If tonight turns out badly, even if he does turn out to be the nominee, he is so fatally wounded going into, you know, the election, the general election itself. I don't know how he recovers. And I guess my biggest fear is that they actually do dump Romney, Gingrich, Paul, and Santorum and come up with somebody who is not part of this Cirque du Soleil that they've had out there for us for the last couple of months.
Well, I've been thinking along the lines of they dump them and they go with Jeb, and we have another Bush.
Which, you know, for in many people's minds is like too many Bushes.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's starting with a clean slate. There is something about the electorate these days that the less they know about you, the happier they are with you.
Yeah. That's a sad statement about our society.
It certainly is. I mean, hence the popularity of Herman Cain and Sarah Palin and people that people didn't know anything about. They just wanted something new. And I'm hoping he's wounded, but not wounded enough not to stick in as the nominee.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm kind of pushing for, there's part of me that hopes that Santorum pops out of this. Cause I think there, you know, and again, I'm starting to think of 1980, and I've talked about this extensively. My concern is that we have that 1980 moment again where you get who you wanted, like the Carter people wanted Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have some catastrophe like, cause I fully expect the powers to be to crash the economy sometime, near the election. The October surprise will be $6 a gallon gas or something along those lines, just to get Obama out and put whoever insaniac ends up, carrying the nomination for the Republicans.
I've got to tell you though, as a woman, Santorum as the nominee, he is a true believer in many respects on these social issues. And we cannot afford, and when I say we, I mean women, working women, women of reproductive age, we cannot afford a Santorum firing up troops on his conservative social values. They are very scary to a lot of women who thought that those battles were fought 50, 60, 70 years ago, and certainly the battle for the ability to have safe contraceptive. We thought that one was long over, and
yeah.
he has, you know, fueled that fire.
But that's always been under the undercurrent of the conservative movement, not just Roe versus Wade, but going back to Griswold and undoing that as well.
You know, I don't, and you know, maybe it's good because maybe a lot of people who thought it was only about late-term abortions or it was about, you know, things that they, you know, were having problems with, you know, and saying, wow, it's only about that. Now that they see that it's about all contraceptives, just like in the healthcare bill, it's not about the Catholic Church and it having to give its employees in dioceses, you know, free contraceptives in their health plan. They now have made it very clear it's about any employer who has any doubts about whether or not this is something that they believe in, that they will impose that religious belief on anybody who works for them.
Yep.
And so the spokesperson for the Catholic bishop said it best. If I were not doing this job and I owned a restaurant, I don't want to have to be told that I have to provide contraceptive care. That's not what I want to do. And so I'll fight this, you know, in the broader aspect. And I think for most women, it's totally unacceptable.
Yeah, I can't imagine that there's a woman left on this continent willing to vote for a Republican based on the shenanigans of the last couple of weeks. But I saw this statement by former senator and now current governor of Kansas, Sam Brownback, who a woman had called into C-SPAN and said, you know, why are you trying to take this away? And well, his snip response was this:
if a woman then wants birth control, go work somewhere else.
That's the response from the folks. If you don't like it, go somewhere else.
You know what I find wholly ludicrous is that these men think this is a woman's issue. I got news for them. It's about them too. You know, anyone who thinks that he's entitled to have family planning between himself and his wife ought to think long and hard about whether or not people who say that, you know, they don't want any interference in their personal lives, suddenly want to tell you whether or not you can buy contraceptives.
Now, understand. This is the...
I think of Ireland that didn't allow for... You couldn't get contraceptives in Ireland. You couldn't get a divorce in Ireland. The church ran the country.
Yeah.
And I guess as long as we can all agree on which church is going to run the country, that's okay in Rick Santorum's mind.
Yeah, and you go back and you wonder about the 60s when people were concerned about Kennedy. I've said that, you know, Santorum is what they were worried about. They shouldn't have worried about Kennedy. Santorum's the guy to worry about. But, you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, the people who tell me that they want smaller, less intrusive government are the very people who are telling me that they need to use the government to be in my life, and not only to be in my life, but also mandate people who go to a church and what they have to believe and what they have to go through. I mean, that's just mind-boggling to me.
Well, they're building on pieces that they have had all over in individual states for a very long time. They, you know, they started with this conscience clause for doctors that went to a conscience clause for your druggist. He didn't have to give you certain medications if he didn't believe in them. This is not the kind of society that we thought we were living in 2012. This is far beyond what most of us will tolerate.
So let's take this back to Michigan. Because I can't imagine that Michigan's going to vote for either one of these or any of them come November. But who do you think is going to take it today? I mean, as of right now, it's too close to call, and there's even a possibility where they split the delegates. I'm curious where your thoughts are.
Possibly they will split the delegates, and there will be a strong segment for Santorum. He has surged in the last couple of days. But they do have early voting, and so the earlier votes may have gone to Romney. I think they're reporting a lower turnout than expected today, which probably hurts the guy who's surging at the end, which would be Santorum. So you may have people in the Detroit area and Detroit suburbs who are going to vote for Santorum as a protest to how Romney has basically, dissed the bailout of the auto workers. The auto industry, which is a primary industry there. There might be a whole lot of things. For Romney, tying with Santorum is a huge loss in a state that where he won 4 years ago, in a state where his father was governor, in a state where his family had roots, where he claims he was raised and where the trees are the right height. You know, for him, losing with those kind of trees, it's going to put him behind the eight ball.
But it doesn't finish him off, which is what I'm hoping he does. Because I want this thing to play out until April to make Pennsylvania actually a state that matters.
Well, I think everybody knows the other shoe drops on Super Tuesday in the South when Gingrich's Adelson money is now buying commercials in those southern states that will vote on Super Tuesday. And so once again, you know, we have a two-man race that now becomes a different two-man race when some very heavy-duty corporate money comes into play.
Yeah. You mentioned low voter turnout. You know, what people have been telling me is that there are so many people who want Obama out, and the country's in the wrong direction, all of this stuff. State after state, low turnout. I've yet to see that kind of enthusiasm to get the president out, or is it that it's just nobody's enthusiastic about these four clowns?
I think you have political operatives that are spinning it the way they want it. But, you know, having been in Colorado 4 years ago for the caucuses there and watching high schools have lines three times around a building for people to try and get in for Democratic caucuses, that's when there's enthusiasm. That's when we wanted a president gone. That's when people really were, you know, they're at their wit's end and they were willing to stand out in a cold, you know, March 1st and make something different happen. You're not seeing that right now. People are tired of this, what seems to be, you know, going into divisive social issues, the inane conversations about not believing science. I would think for most good government Republicans that, you know, used to know what their party was about, that this year has been a horrible surprise, that even the one candidate that they thought could bridge the gap between old good government Republicans and new socially conservative Republicans, which would be Romney, that the gap is way too wide.
Yep. So it will be interesting to see the results of tonight. Like I said, I want this horse race to continue. I'm happy watching them beat each other up. The last question I've got for you, one of my favorite statements of Romney, and it's not really, I guess, a question, but my favorite statement is he's not concerned about poor people because they have safety nets. And I look at how even the Santorum types, this is a Christian nation types, keep talking about cutting and gutting government spending and gutting programs that help the poor and help the needy. Is this the party of greed? Is this the 1% party now? I mean, are they fully that far gone?
You know, it's a good question. For a party that cloaks itself in religious fervor, I don't think they ever read the Beatitudes. I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. I was in prison and you visited me. You know, if those are the marks of what they call the Christian conservative movement, I think they better go back and read some more.
Yep. Good point. Joanne Fitzgerald, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you. Please come back again real soon.
Thanks so much. Take care.
The website, AmericanVotes.org, AmericaVotes.org. We got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Karl Rove, the supreme sleazemeister of negative political advertising, complained about a recent television ad. I was frankly offended by it. Wow, that's like a skunk saying some other critter stinks. What could possibly make an ad so offensive that Karl would gag? Hope, that's what. The sweet flower of optimism nauseates Karl. The ad was Chrysler's Super Bowl spot. Aired during halftime of the game, it featured Clint Eastwood in a darkened factory saying, "It's halftime in America, too. People are out of work and they're hurting," he said, "but revival is coming from the American people's can-do spirit. Detroit's showing us it can be done." "Our country can't be knocked out with one punch," Eastwood declared. "We get right back up again. Yeah, it's halftime, America, and our second half is about to begin." Rove hated Chrysler's upbeat message and went on Fox TV to lambast the 2008 bailout of America's auto industry, even though it was a success. Unable to stop himself from publicly stomping on one of the few flowers to bloom in our shattered economy, The sour and surly Carl even suggested the ad was a political favor from the industry to President Obama for providing rescue funds. I hate to interrupt Rove's nasty tantrum with a dose of reality, but the auto bailout was initiated not by Obama, but by George W. Bush, for whom Rove worked. And, in an embarrassing happenstance, on the very day that Carl was fulminating on Fox, Bush himself was expressing pride in helping save the industry, pointedly saying, "I'd do it again." This is Jim Hightower saying, "Rove is the one with a crass partisan agenda. He's now amassing a $100 million war chest to carpet bomb Obama with negative TV ads. So he's offended by any positive message about America's future. Rove is the sickness in today's politics."
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Life can be a challenge. Life can seem impossible. It's never easy when there's so much on the line. But you and I can make a difference.
There's something wrong when you're stealing from Pokemon. I miss Cheesy Dwarf. He's of all of the presidential candidates of this whole thing. I miss Michelle Bachmann, but I really do miss Cheesy Dwarf. I miss Herman Cain. And he did. He said he was going to stick around. Where is he? Where's the Herminator? Where's Herm, as Sarah Palin calls him? Where's the Cain man? Where's the Herman Cain train? I thought he'd be everywhere. We went up to New Hampshire just to see him. That's it. And he didn't show up. Stiffed us, he did. Just the night before. Sad. Sure miss him. Maybe in the at the convention, maybe they'll dump all the other ones. Maybe Herman and his 909 plan. Maybe that's where we'll be going. I guess it just shows you the whole direction of the party. And it's amazing to me. In fact, I loved another Romney, call it whatever you want, but he had said at a campaign rally that Kid Rock's DVDs introduce him everywhere he goes. Again, you know, just like you and me, you know, just like you and I, you know, we're the guy. He's just one of the buds. We're gonna listen to DVDs together as we drive down the road. Wow. Well, it is what it is, I guess. And like I said before, I would have more respect for him if he said, "Look, I really don't have a clue what you're talking about. I don't know anything about NASCAR. And yeah, I do know people who own the teams, and that's about as much as I know about it. I know it's like traffic. I don't like it." I wish at some point he'd be honest. And the question is you know, if he's the job creator, look at the jobs that he's claimed to have created. And Bloomberg did a nice piece on this about his so-called job creation. If you buy into all of the rhetoric, if you buy into the fact that he claims to have created 100,000 jobs, look at the places he did it at. Staples, Sports Authority, places where the wage is pretty pathetic. Even for the industry, they're lower than everyone else's. In fact, what the report said is the average compensation, including benefits across the retail industry, from the CEO down to the baggage person, $17.15 an hour. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. You compare that with the manufacturing industry, with the manufacturing sector, almost $33 an hour between wages and benefits for everyone up and down the chain. And the question that I have is, you know, you look at the Walmart. Walmart makes huge profits. The question is, how much goes to the Romney types, to the CEO types? How much goes to them, and how much goes to the lowly cashier or the bag person, or the person who goes and gets the carts or stocks the shelves or unloads the trucks or sweeps the floors or does anything in the store that actually makes the profit? Where's that distribution? And this is where I keep coming back to the point where we absolutely need to have labor unions in this country to kind of level that playing field. Not completely. You're never going to make what the CEO is making, but you should be able to make a decent living. You should be able to feed your kids. You should be able to put a roof over your head if you're working 40 hours a week. And you shouldn't have to worry about if you get sick, you're going to get fired and you're going to end up out in the street and lose your home and lose your health care and end up dying because of it. That isn't this country to me. That isn't the vision that I have. But that's where the right wants to take us. That's where these radicals want to take us. And even if you buy the fact that, you know, he created jobs, these jobs, Bloomberg points out, on one, the industry, $17.15 an hour from CEO down. In the Staples Sports Authority world, $11.92 an hour. So you're talking about a huge difference just in, and you go, well, gee, how are they putting everybody else out of business? They're cheating their workers. The same way Walmart came to be the king of the hill, they basically stole from their workers. And it's well documented. Before they were a national chain, they got started in Arkansas by the old man cheating people out of their breaks and out of wages. Oh, but he's someone to be worshipped. He's an icon. And I go back to that story I talked about at the beginning, about the study about, you know, rich people being greedy. And rich people not having a problem stealing candy from the mouths of children? Yeah, of course. They understand manipulating. They understand cheating because they never get punished for it. You know, when they were the kids, their parents didn't smack them for stealing from the candy bar. They patted them on the head. Nice job. Do it again next time. And I go back to it, man. You know, am I doing my kids a disservice? You know, are middle-class families doing their kids a disservice by teaching them right from wrong? Because evidently, I mean, you look at this. There is no right and wrong in their world. It's only what they impose down us, which is why I do believe that they want to push religion so heavily, so hard down on the rest of us. You have to believe. I'll believe if I want to believe. And if I want to go to church, which I do, I will. Freely, of my own volition, of my own will. Not having you impose your morality on the rest of us. And all the while you're telling me you're pious and wonderful, I see the things that you do. And I look at this budget that this governor here in Pennsylvania has put forth, and I go, this is immoral. It's wrong. Why aren't there groups daily? And you know what? There probably are. It's just that our corporate-controlled for-profit media never picks it up. Or doesn't think enough of it. This budget, gutting education again? Gutting social programs again? How much more? How much more do we have to do this? How much more do we have to steal from the future of our kids? Just let me know. I mean, let me know. Let me know how much we're going to screw college kids into the future. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Chase Kajravi, professor at Slippery Rock University, about these massive cuts, what it's going to mean to kids at Slippery Rock University, what it's going to mean to kids here in Pennsylvania, really the competitiveness of the state. This is just, well, you know what it is. It's a screw job. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're a proud defender of a working class majority. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, how a team of astronomers made a better yardstick for measuring distances across space. Astronomer Fritz Benedict of the University of Texas and his team have directly measured distances to five variable stars called R.R. Lyrae stars.
Up until our work, though, we'd had no really good measure of the intrinsic brightness of this kind of star.
Benedict's team used a very precise instrument aboard the Hubble Space Telescope combined with an old technique for measuring star distances called stellar parallax.
And basically, parallax is very easy to understand. You just hold a finger up in front of your nose and open and shut your eyes and alternate. You watch your finger bounce back and forth against the background, and the further away your finger is, the less of a bounce back and forth there is.
Knowing the distances to R.R. Lyrae variable stars is important because these stars are one of the stepping stones used by astronomers to estimate distances across the universe.
So the work is basically the moral equivalent of someone handing you a yardstick and you don't know if it's 30 inches long or 40 inches long. Now we've handed you a yardstick that it's either 35 inches long or 37 inches long. And that's a much better yardstick.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The Rich, who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
So last week, the Arizona House Committee approved House Bill 2675, requiring every student in the state, even the poorest students, to pay a minimum of $2,000 per year to attend the state's public universities. And the reason? Well, according to Republicans in Arizona, they are moving the legislation because nearly half of all those kids in Arizona's three public universities didn't pay tuition in 2009 and 2010, basically blaming financial aid and scholarships and a lot of other programs. The reality, according to Christine Thompson, the Regents Vice President of Government Relations, she said the current numbers are around 25%. And my thought was, 25, 50, Republican world, what's the difference? Especially when your goal is privatizing and profitizing education. But about 100 kids popped in to oppose this bill, saying, hey, you know, it's going to harm us. And they spoke against this. James Allen, one of the University of Arizona students, presidents of student body, he told the legislature by passing the bill, it'd make it harder for folks to achieve a higher education degree, to wit, one of the state representatives, Michelle Ugunti, said, well, welcome to life. And, you know, I'm kind of guessing that's the Republican response here in Pennsylvania as well. Now, Arizona has the highest tuition rate in the country. But don't fret. Pennsylvania's governor is working on it. Pennsylvania will be number one if he has his way, which is why I've asked Dr. Chase Kadravy to come talk to us. She's a professor at Slippery Rock University, one of the state-owned, one of the state schools of higher education. She's also a chapter president of ABSCOF that represents the faculty there. Dr. Kadravy, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, you're welcome.
You know, I look at the statement, welcome to life, and there's part of me that goes, that's what some people are thinking. You know, hey, kids, life's tough. Welcome to it.
Well, it seems, life is difficult, isn't it? But it seems a rather flip response, I think, to an entire generation who have been encouraged by their parents, as they well should have been, and by others in business and in industry to pursue a higher education as a way of moving them closer to the kind of life that has been a goal for them, where they're financially stable and employed in their field of study. So it seems sort of a flip response when we've been encouraging students with good reason to get at least some experience in higher education and preferably to complete a degree.
Right. You know, I've talked to a number of people who have those kind of flip responses. And I think part of it is a lack of education on their part, because they're thinking back to when they were in college or back, you know, when you know, they knew people who were in college, a completely different environment. And I just think about myself, you know, back in the mid to late 80s, I went to college and it is a completely different world. In fact, when I was talking to Steve Hicks, the president of APSCUF, and he was saying, look, you know, back in 1982, the state picked up about two-thirds of the cost of running the higher education system. Now 75% is picked up by student tuition. You've seen a massive, massive shift in who's paying the bill.
Yes, I know. It seems incomprehensible that a state-owned system of higher education should be stepping away from what we see as its responsibilities to support that that state system. And it is it truly is a quality system. I understand that from the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems that Pennsylvania's public universities rank among the nation's best, and that among all of our states, Pennsylvania ranks fourth in six-year graduation rates, second in student matriculation from ninth grade to college graduation, fourth in the number of degrees confirmed, and fifth in college retention rates. So it's not only that there's a state-owned system, but the system is one that has been functioning effectively and efficiently over the years, but that doesn't seem to earn it any additional support from the state. As you indicated, it's declining and continues to decline, and the burden for paying it begins to fall on students. We don't have a dedicated revenue stream to support the state-owned system, and that's becoming more and more problematic. I mean, I think, you know, raises in tuition, which the state system has worked very hard to keep down, is difficult during any time, and then of course it's even more difficult during a time when the entire nation is suffering, financially.
Let me ask you this. I mean, because you ticked off some pretty impressive, statistics there. I mean, the system is doing really well. It must be worth a lot of money. I mean, you know, we've got a governor who has a privatization committee that they're looking at stuff to privatize. Maybe we could sell those off and make a tidy little short-term profit.
Yeah. It certainly seems as though he obviously hasn't shared his master plan with me, but it certainly seems as though he's leaning in that direction. And what I think is just so hurtful about this is that the students who come to our public universities are those who come from working class families and lower middle class families, and they simply cannot afford to attend private schools. I mean, really, the state system schools are their best hope in getting a quality higher education in Pennsylvania. And I guess what also strikes me as being short-sighted by the governor's proposal is that I understand that, an average college degree holder makes something like $470,000 more in income over the course of a lifetime than the average non-degree holder. And what that translates to, apparently, is that the state recoups in inflation-adjusted dollars nearly $6 in return for every dollar that they invest, because 80% of our students stay in state and become part of the working force here and part of the tax base here. So it just seems a very short-sighted approach to funding higher education. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, it doesn't make any sense, but I think you've just articulated the reason we need to destroy any education, because you're just too smart. You just make those arguments that just make a lot of sense, and it just kind of flies in the face of what they're trying to do, which is, I think, in my opinion, destroy the system. So with you out there, you know, doing this, you're hurting them. Don't you see that?
Exactly. Yeah. I just find that the decreasing lack of support, as you indicated, to be just unfathomable. I mean, when the state system came into existence, it had a state-mandated mission to provide accessible, affordable, high-quality education at the lowest possible cost to students, and it seems like the governor's proposed budget cut seems to undermine that mission.
Yeah.
It, as you said, it just doesn't make any sense.
And here's my problem, and on a serious note, and that's, you know, just being facetious there with a couple of the comments, but seriously, you look at yesterday's Wall Street Journal, there was an article about high-tech manufacturing and the fact that they believe, this is coming from the American Enterprise Institute, so take it for what it's worth, but there are 600,000 high-paying jobs, according to them, that are going unfilled because workers don't have the skills. And you look at study after study that says that while you can go after the attacks on workers' right to work and all of that nonsense, businesses look for places that have good education, have smart workforce, skilled workforce. What's frightening to me is that you look at these massive and devastating cuts to not only K-12 education, but higher ed as well. What it's doing is it's making Pennsylvania, like Mississippi or some of the poorer states that don't have the resource or the ability to invest in higher ed. And we're at some point going to lose what little manufacturing we have and not be able to attract, the high priced, high labor manufacturing of the future.
Yes, I absolutely. It just seems as though the attitude, seems to me rather than extending the kind of support that our very young citizens need to rise to their full potential and to make the kinds of contributions to the state that one would, whether it's in industry or in education or in business, that we would want them to make, instead of doing that, we're withdrawing that support and creating a larger class of individuals who maybe ultimately end up requiring state support in less fortunate circumstances, whether that be welfare or finding themselves in the prison system, which I understand gets well funded. It just seems to be creating a larger gap between the haves and the have-nots. You know, that higher education is fine for those who are fortunate enough to be born into a financially well-to-do family and can afford private college tuition rates, and there's a big gap growing between the young adults who can access the financial resources to go to private institutions and those who haven't been born into such fortunate circumstances. And it seems that the message is, well, that's just tough.
Yeah.
You'll just have to do without a degree. You'll just have to give up your dreams. You'll just have to give up on the aspirations that you have had in, for particular careers. And it's an incredibly negative and dismissive a response to an entire generation of Pennsylvanians.
Yeah, and what's frustrating to me is, maybe you're seeing different because you're right there on the campuses, but I'm not seeing the outrage that I think you should see in communities and around this state. I think people should be in the streets screaming at the top of their lungs because education, as we've been told, is that great equalizer. It's going to give you the opportunity to do better so that, my kids will do better than I did.
Mm-hmm.
If we take that link away, we take that ability to get that education, I'm fearful for what the future holds for my kids.
Exactly. I mean, I am too. And I mean, I certainly have a great deal of sympathy for the governor of any state during these times. You know, when I know that budgets are very tight and there may be deficits to address, but I think that you have to take a longer term view in where you choose to place the limited resources that you have. And it just seems that the choice that this governor is making is short-sighted and ultimately will hurt the state, as you said, reducing its stature in terms of the value it places on education to some of the other states where we roll our eyes when we hear how poor their college attendance is and how poor their graduation rates are. And it just seems to me that Pennsylvania shouldn't want to go in that direction, that we should be striving to move forward and to progress rather than to take steps backwards.
So let me get this straight, then.
Yeah.
You're saying that the governor has made poor choices? You mean giving huge tax breaks to corporations while gutting education? That's a poor choice while leaving the magic box in Delaware wide open to scrub profits away while cutting, Head Start programs? Those are bad choices?
Yeah, yes. I guess I would say that. In fact, you know what? We have discovered here is that the $250 million or so that he would be not even saving, but that he wouldn't be giving to higher education, happens to match up with the $250 million that is the projected loss in revenue from his elimination of the business asset tax. So it's not even as though he's saying, okay, we need to cut your appropriations by 20% because we have a terrible deficit and this is going to help. Everybody's going to suffer. It's not that what he's doing. He's taking it out of one pocket and putting it in another. And so it just seems as though our younger generation is being penalized unnecessarily. Really.
I would say
the money is there.
I would say fleeced, robbed, ripped off. Those are the words that I would use. You're obviously much more learned than I am. I use more direct words. Let me ask you the last question I've got for you. You know, as you're talking to the students on campus, as you're interacting with folks, how are they reacting to this? Because, you know, I remember the kid that I met here said, if this goes through and I can't get the funding, there's nowhere for me to go. The factory's closed where my grandfather and father worked. There's nothing for me to go back to. My future's done. So I'm curious what you're hearing, who you're talking to.
Well, yeah, I hear a similar thing. We had a big rally on campus today that was attended by 400-plus individuals, mostly students, but certainly faculty and staff as well. And the students there are outraged, and they're very worried about their futures. They are busily filling out postcards to send to the governor, and I know that tomorrow and for the next several days, the student government here is working on a letter-writing campaign. Students are definitely worried about their futures because they know that it was very difficult to have to absorb the 7.5% increase in tuition that was the result of the cuts from last year. They are just at a loss as to how they're going to have to handle continued raises in their tuition. They just don't know what they're going to do. They're extraordinarily worried about it.
Yeah, so much for No Child Left Behind.
Exactly. Well, excellent point.
Dr. Chase Kadravi, I appreciate the time. As this continues, we'd love to have you back to tell us what's going on there at Slippery Rock University. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Chase Kadravi, a professor at Slippery Rock, also the chapter president of APSCUF. Quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, I'm working all the time.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays, were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833. And consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child laborers constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more strict stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. Because God is a Republican.
Oh, yes, lock those little buggers up. You know, you look at and I think Dr. Gadrevi made a good point. You know, we're cutting education funding while funding fully prisons. Does it seem like there's some kind of a conflict there? Because we know, you know, people with lower academic achievement, lower opportunity, lesser opportunity, they're the ones at a higher rate that end up as guests of the state. And I shouldn't even say guests of the state anymore, because we're privatizing prisons at such an alarming rate that it's not even really the state anymore. It's private for-profit corporations, multinationals who are doing it. There's part of me that goes, is there any surprise that you're seeing the lobby to cut, gut, and punish education? I would not be surprised in the least if you found that there was some prison group out there lobbying for lower funding for education. Wouldn't surprise me in the least. Not at all. But what you're seeing is this major push towards privatization, major push towards profitizing education, and it's scaring to me. And sometime today, and I'm waiting for the vote to happen, the House of Representatives is supposed to vote on this Protecting Academic Freedom in Higher Education Act. I love that. Isn't that great? Protecting Academic Freedom. Like, you know, we're going to be able to learn things and things are going to be great. Turns out, it's one of these things where you go, hold on, are you kidding me? It's basically a defense of the schools that are diploma mills. Basically, that's what it is. Because the Department of Education wanted to standardize the definition of a credit hour. So, you know, because I've run into this at places, because I, before I got my bachelor's, I went to a couple of different places, and there were different standards. You know, people go on 3 credit hours for a class, some go on 4, you know, some are weighted differently. So the Department of Education said, you know, as a higher education system, should be standardized across the board. Everything should be given equal value. So it makes sense to me. Well, the Republicans, no, not so much. Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina, the chief sponsor of the bill, put in her press release that the heavy-handed regulation threatens to crush the very innovation and the very innovative new programs we need to make education more affordable and efficient. The House Education and Workforce Committee Chairman, John Klein, Republican from Minnesota, this legislation will protect student choice, reduce job-destroying regulation, and encourage the establishment of more innovative programs to better serve both students and the local workforce. We're protecting private for-profit colleges. We're protecting diploma mills. And I think back to the story about the school, the charter school in Tampa, and the consultant that they brought in, Dr. Hanan Islam, who received two doctorates from Rockville College University. It's basically a diploma. You send them a couple bucks, they send you a diploma. And then the Eden Institute, which nobody's heard of. So we're protecting them at the expense of everybody else. Now, understand, I'd be okay with that if it was just your money. The problem is you look at these for-profit colleges, the ones who have CEOs making $25 million, especially the online versions of them, which there's almost no regulation of online education. As long as they can find someone to give them an accreditation for as long as they can keep it, they can get federal money. And they're getting tons of federal money. And we're the ones that end up footing the bill. When you could go to a state system school for a fairly reasonable tuition, triple, quadruple that going to these online for-profit ones. I think somebody told me that, like the University of Phoenix was like $500 a credit hour, or Walden or any of those. They're in the multiple hundreds per credit hour. So you're talking about $1,500 a class. I mean, think of how much money's in that. And the Republicans, again, had to throw in that shot. It's going to kill jobs. Job-killing regulation. To me, it's common sense. You should have some standardization. If a college credit in California is worth one credit, it should be worth one credit in New York, or one credit in Mississippi, or one credit here in Pennsylvania. But the reality is, these Republicans, they don't want anybody watching the beat. What they want is they want you to get screwed, and oh, by the way, then you can go sue if you want. But it's not going to do you much good because the law is not on your side. And if they screw enough of you, which we found out thanks to our Supreme Court, good luck filing a class action lawsuit against them. Not going to happen. If anything that the AT&T case taught me is, if I'm going to screw somebody, I'm going to screw a whole bunch of people for a little bit of money so that it's not worth them going after me. I have $1,500, so it's not worth them coming after me individually because they can't come after me as a group. Thank you, conservative Supreme Court. Thank you for being pro-business. Appreciate that, because we need to be more business-friendly. Because that's what they keep telling us, right? If we were just more business-friendly, they would create more jobs. If we just killed all those regulations, we'd have more jobs. So if we don't put this standardization of what a credit hour is, if this were to sort of go into effect, that would kill jobs. And my question is, how? Can someone explain that? How would that kill jobs? By having a set of standards that everyone plays by. That would be like the Steelers or the Cowboys or the Eagles saying, you don't want those rules, they would hurt our team. We don't want any rules for us. Rules for everybody else. Yes, rules for everybody else. No rules for us. How many people do you think would agree with that? I mean, understand, what goes on is just like any game you'll ever play. There's got to be rules. There's got to be some standard set of understandings. If you want to call it, instead of you don't like rules, call them understandings. Some standard line that everyone goes, okay, that's the line. This is what we have to pay attention to. Republicans don't want that. They want you to get screwed whenever they can screw you. And I look at this and it's just mind blowing to me. And you look at the fact that these college kids right now have been saddled with such enormous debt. It's just sad. Let's take a quick break, right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The bottom line is that the oil companies want the price of gasoline and heating oil and jet fuel to increase. They're not happy making billions. They want to make more money. That's what they're in business to do. They're not in business to help the driving public. They're not in business to help senior citizens on fixed income pay for heating oil. That's not what the oil companies are about.
United Steelworkers Local 10234 President Dennis Stefano. Big Oil is shutting down some East Coast refineries, wiping out about 3,000 jobs as they export gasoline produced in the U.S. and drive the prices of gasoline and home heating oil ever higher. The steelworkers are fighting these moves, demanding that the federal government get aggressive in reining in Big Oil in the public interest. If you're feeling the pain at the pump, Stefano urges you to call your congressman and the White House to demand that a leash be put on big oil.
I think it's important that anybody who spends money on gasoline or heating oil write their congressman, write the Energy Committee in Washington, D.C., write Jeff Bingaman from New Mexico. Ask him to conduct hearings and express your frustration. Write the White House and express your frustration at the price of gasoline and heating oil. The oil companies need to be reined in. We need to keep these refineries running in the United States. They're good middle-class paying jobs.
USW says the restriction of gas and home heating oil supplies caused by these refinery shutdowns could endanger East Coast home heating oil supplies. The union says it could even be a national security issue should a disaster strike other refineries or pipelines. The art world was punked early Monday morning when a press release circulated purporting to be from the Whitney Museum of American Art. Jesse Russell reports.
The New York-based museum is hosting its biennial in March, and the fake release, accompanied by a fake website, said the organization would be returning sponsorship money from Sotheby's and Deutsche Bank. The release claimed the museum was unhappy with a decision by Sotheby's to lock out 43 union art handlers when their contract expired in July of 2011. While seeing record profits and giving a raise to their CEO. The fake press release said the break with Deutsche Bank was due to allegations of mortgage and investor fraud. The Whitney acknowledged on Monday that it did not send the press release. The press release followed a strongly worded statement from Occupy Wall Street calling for an end to the biennial. The statement said it upholds a system that benefits collectors, trustees, and corporations at the expense of art workers.
This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So Monday, the folks at WikiLeaks began publishing what they're calling the Global Intelligence Files, some 5 million emails that they had gotten from one of these global intelligence companies, the name of this one, Stratfor. The emails are between July of 2004 and December of 2011. And, you know, it's looking at the inner workings of this, what I'm calling you, basically the for-profit intelligence industry, and who they're working for. And one of the things I found very interesting is they were talking about, this woman who had been fired from the CIA, and that she was fired for looking at the trees and being unable to see the forest. And they claim that this gave them an enormous historic opportunity. They say that the CIA model of analysis has been invalidated. I can't make this up. The ponderance, the process-driven machine that could only manage the small things now needs to be replaced by a robust, visionary, a courageous analytic system. And that gives them evidently some ability. I like visionary. And those are the kind of people I want. Those are the kind of people I want analyzing important intelligence data. People with vision. Anyway, that's why I've asked Tim Shirock, author of Spies for Hire. He's a journalist who covers the private intelligence industry. Tim, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much.
You know, what are your, just off the top of your head, what are your thoughts on these, on the global intelligence files? How much of this is real? How much of it is you know, just a much ado about nothing?
Well, first of all, there is something that Stratfor does, which I think is very questionable, which is, well, more than questionable, it's immoral, which is, keeping tabs on organizations and individuals that the government doesn't like, that people that are active against government secrecy, people that are actively, you know, opposition to various policies of the government, and they keep track of them. And, they kept track of groups that are also critical of corporations like Coca-Cola. And, you know, there was files in there about, you know, watching PETA, you know, P- people for the ethical treatment of animals, for Coca-Cola, and that kind of thing. You know, that's kind of insidious. And I think we should pay attention to that. But overall, in terms of like, you know, intelligence, looking at this as intelligence of value, I didn't find much in there that was very interesting. In fact, I found a lot of it quite laughable, what I could read on, that was actually on the site. And I think it was way overhyped by WikiLeaks itself. They made it sound like it really uncovered some, you know, huge cache of information that would show, you know, they called it the shadow CIA, which in some ways it is, but you know, I found it, some of the cables and some of the sources they have very hard to believe, you know, I found them very questionable.
Well, and I think that's been a lot of people's sentiment on this, but you know, those of us who care that our government doesn't privatize the functions of our intelligence agencies, you know, I look at the CIA and they're talking about here's an opportunity to take over some of that, really show what we can do. And at one point they say, you know, take a break and dream big and think big and imagine, because they're going to take it over. So I guess my question is the CIA model changed, or is it different in any way?
Well, I think in some ways, yes, it has, but not really to the benefit of Stratford. I mean, the CIA has, you know, for years, what it does is, you know, sends agents abroad and they collect information and participate in, you know, covert operations that supposedly benefit us here in the United States, and usually it benefits some kind of corporation or financial organization. But, you know, aside from that, you know, they were caught up and they were torturing people in Guantanamo, and they were running this secret torture program. They were under fire for that. And, they were also in battles within, you know, the Bush administration around Iraq over whether Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. They came out on the side that they did not, and they turned out to be right. Right now they're saying, CIA and other agencies are saying that, you know, Iran doesn't plan on building a nuclear bomb right now. And so they're kind of at odds a little bit with some other schools, you know, other parts of the national security infrastructure. But what I would say in terms of, like, you know, users of this Stratfor information is, you know, according to WikiLeaks, it is bought by the Defense Intelligence Agency, which collects intelligence for the Joint Chiefs and the Pentagon, the Marine Corps, as well as the Department of Homeland Security. And from what you just read, it seems like, you know, they're really hyping themselves, this company, as sort of an alternative, or perhaps, you know, something that could be substituted for CIA analysis. And, you know, that kind of raises the question of, you know, in the past we've had, like, competing schools of intelligence over very critical issues such as, you know, how advanced the Soviet economy was and how advanced the Soviet military infrastructure and, you know, their own national security complex was, whether Iraq had, you know, weapons of mass destruction. And sometimes there's been these, what they've called these, you know, Team B groups have been formed to create an alternative to what's been coming out of the CIA. And I think you have a danger of that here, of a company that's you know, flogging itself as this great intelligence, source of intelligence, and selling their work to other agencies that might use it to build a possible kind of, you know, counterintelligence story to what's coming out of the CIA or another agency.
Yeah, especially when you start talking about in terms of being robust, visionary, and courageous. That leads me down the line of you're just going to make stuff up.
Exactly. You're going to make it stuff up. You're going to blow your sources up to make it look like they're really important and you really have key sources. Now, there's one story in here that's been written by Mother Jones and by the London Telegraph, which has to do with, according to some of these Stratfor cables, they obtained information, they obtained some of the documents that were taken during the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan. And I find that very hard to believe. I find it hard to believe that Stratfor would get those documents. And I also find it hard to believe that if they did, they would talk about it in email. I just don't find that credible at all. And I think that reporters who actually wrote stories about that without questioning the veracity of the cables, were making a huge leap. And I think it's a journalistic, you know, mistake.
Or it's just being naive and not understanding the intelligence world, because, you know,
exactly.
Why would you, if it's this top secret and you've got this guy, why would you put it in an email when you know that millions of them are being hacked and you know that it's not all that difficult?
Exactly. I mean, that's what I mean. I mean, why would they put it in an email? If they actually did, I mean, this was like, you know, a very, you know, high security operation to go kill bin Laden and collect the computer disks and communal laptops he had in his compound. And there have not been leaks like, you know, like of that magnitude from the Special Operations Command at all. And then they're, you know, trained to keep all this stuff, you know, really, you know, close and highly classified. And that some Stratford guy in Pakistan would just sort of get it in a matter of hours, just seems pretty ludicrous. And, you know, again, yeah, there must be some naivete on the part of the reporters who wrote that, because I just don't see it's possible.
Yeah, you mean bin Laden didn't have his secretary? It wasn't on her computer? No.
Perhaps. Yeah, she was just taking notes on her knee, you know, maybe they got those. So, you know, I'm sure that they can, you know, provide some, you know, interesting information about countries. I mean, if you have people there,
right,
and they talk to people, and you can pass it on, and, you know, that forms, you know, intelligence reports. But, you know, how far up the chain and, you know, in governments they get is, you know, who knows. But they sure make it sound like they're really, you know, they're almost an alternative to the CIA.
It's a nice sales game is what it is.
Yeah, that's what it is. And, you know, one of the problems of privatized intelligence, as opposed to, you know, intelligence completely under control of the government, is that when you have private companies involved, they get a contract and they want to get another contract to provide more intelligence. And so, you know, this, I think that has a, you know, an effect on the intelligence of trying to, you know, try to sell the value of what you have. Whether you have anything or not, you try to hype it. And I think, you know, they want to get another contract, so they want to show that they have very, you know, very confidential and high-level sources in a country like Pakistan or Mexico.
Right.
And, in fact, they don't even, you know, one of the questions I had about these cables is that apparently they, meaning Stratfor, when they talk to people, don't identify themselves as intelligence, don't identify themselves as journalists. And it raises the question to me, exactly how do they represent themselves? Who do their sources think they're talking to? You know, is it, you know, because oftentimes, you know, the CIA, of course, goes abroad. They develop sources, and they don't always say that they're CIA, but often they do. And often they cultivate somebody knowing that that person knows they are CIA. And they become, you know, part of that CIA agent's, you know, web of people that they're involved in a country like, you know, Mexico or Japan or Pakistan, wherever. And if you don't identify yourself, you know, that creates some problems. And, I think especially, you know, but do they sometimes pretend they're journalists? If they do that, that's a danger to journalists.
Yeah.
And it just raised a lot of questions to me as I read through their claims.
Well, as I look through this, and what's concerning to me is the whole privatization angle of this. And I understand that, you know, there's this plausible deniability by having a private for-profit corporation outside of government holding all the information that government may want to have. But that's what frightens me, that you have these private corporations that think this stuff up, and they're given contracts based on their performance of getting politicians are getting, you know, warlords, whatever you want to call them, the information that they want, so that they can use it to take us into a place like Iraq, who, you know, as you've said, didn't have weapons of mass destruction. I personally think that they did, because we sold them to them. But that's a whole other argument for another day.
You had a question there? Or
No, I mean, just the whole privatization angle. That's the
well. Yeah, I mean, I've written about this in my book, and I think it's an industry that's way beyond. It's, you know, it's way out of control, and you know, when we have, you know, 70% of our intelligence budget going to these contractors, you have to really wonder about the quality of intelligence we're actually getting.
So how do you rein it in?
You know, it's one thing to pay for technology, and the one thing to, you know, certain kinds of, you know, equipment that can, you know, that can be used in intelligence gathering. But it's another to be paying, you know, corporations, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for people, for intelligence officers and agents. You know, I think we need to have a government, you know, cadre of people that collect intelligence and analyze intelligence so that are under government oversight and congressional oversight, as opposed to this, you know, very, you know, because the problem with these contractors is that a lot of their budgets are classified, contracts are classified, and they're often almost impossible to find. the, you know, what they're, who, what agencies these contractors are actually working for and what they're actually doing for them.
Right. So how do we rein this in? Or can you?
Well, I think reining in intelligence contracting and outsourcing and privatization is sort of along the same lines of reining in contracting and privatization everywhere.
Right.
Because I think, you know, those of us who think that it's a problem have to point out and find examples of, you know, why it is a problem and build a public case against it. Although, you know, there have been some laws passed to try to rein in contracting a bit and to have, you know, agencies, not only intelligence, but, you know, defense and, you know, government agencies to take a careful look at how they contract and make sure they don't contract things that are, should only be done by government. And it's the process for that has started a little bit in intelligence, but the, you know, the problem is they have so much power. They can lobby, you know, and in all kinds of ways. You find, you look up an intelligence contractor, a big company like, say, Mantech, which is, you know, has lots of intelligence and defense contracts, and they actually lobby, you know, on the Hill to privatize certain functions that they would like to get their hands on as part of their business. And, you know, I think there's a lot of problems. One way we might be able to start is to limit the amount of money that goes to, you know, that companies can use to lobby when they win it from government contracts. Some of these companies make 95 to 100% of their revenue from the government. And so, you know, it's hard to say that they're even private because they're privately owned companies, but they get all their business from the government. And then they go turn around and they lobby for more business from Congress, and they try to get other areas, you know, other areas where they could penetrate as in, and privatize. And I think that's a real serious problem with our political system.
Now, I'm right there with you. Tim Sharrock, author of Spies for Hire, also a journalist who covers private intelligence and what's going on. Tim, it was great talking to you. I appreciate the input.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. We'll take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Karl Rove, the supreme sleazemeister of negative political advertising, complained about a recent television ad. I was frankly offended by it. Wow, that's like a skunk saying some other critter stinks. What could possibly make an ad so offensive that Karl would gag? Hope, that's what. The sweet flower of optimism nauseates Karl. The ad was Chrysler's Super Bowl spot. Aired during halftime of the game, it featured Clint Eastwood in a darkened factory saying, "It's halftime in America, too. People are out of work and they're hurting," he said, "but revival is coming from the American people's can-do spirit. Detroit's showing us it can be done." "Our country can't be knocked out with one punch," Eastwood declared. "We get right back up again." "Yeah, it's halftime, America. And our second half is about to begin." Rove hated Chrysler's upbeat message and went on Fox TV to lambast the 2008 bailout of America's auto industry, even though it was a success. Unable to stop himself from publicly stomping on one of the few flowers to bloom in our shattered economy, the sour and surly Karl even suggested the ad was a political favor from the industry to President Obama for providing rescue funds. I hate to interrupt Rove's nasty tantrum with a dose of reality, but the auto bailout was initiated not by Obama, but by George W. Bush, for whom Rove worked. And, in an embarrassing happenstance, on the very day that Karl was fulminating on Fox, Bush himself was expressing pride in helping save the industry, pointedly saying, "I'd do it again." This is Jim Hightower saying, "Rove is the one with a crass partisan agenda. He's now amassing a $100 million war chest to carpet bomb Obama with negative TV ads. So he's offended by any positive message about America's future. Rove is the sickness in today's politics."
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I'm great.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So a group of anti-war activists in Utah, they have put up a billboard. And the billboard, you know, basically says, you know, let's bomb Iran. Yeah, bomb Iran, yes. Because it's basically immoral, offensive, and unnecessary. But the idea is they put it up by saying, you know, the military-industrial complex, you know, wants us to bomb. All indications are pushing us towards that. All of the right-wingers are, you know, they're thrilled with the idea. In fact, the group has a website, bombiran.org, where you can get more information. But, you know, the billboard, and I'm surprised that anybody, that they let them put them up. You know, sometimes, you see folks who would, deny them the opportunity. But here again, you know, you look at this and they're right. The military industrial complex wants this. You know, the big headline was support the troops, and they crossed out troops and put military industrial complex, because that's who benefits from this. You go back and you read Smedley Butler's piece, War's a Racket. And, you know, even World War One, World War Two, you name it, the big money made huge money. Conflict means money for them. It means death and bloodshed and pain and misery for people at the bottom. But the wealth class, they benefit pretty wildly from it. And it's just amazing to me that we haven't at some point woken up to the fact that, you know what, they keep rattling the sabers. They keep doing this stuff to us. They keep telling us, well, you know, we'd love to fund education, but, you know, we got to have war. We got to go bomb Iran, or we got to bomb Iraq, or we got to go into Afghanistan, or we've got to be here or there. Think of how much money we've spent on these conflicts. And you look at this report just out yesterday. The Pentagon estimates that it's going to cost about $1 trillion to operate its fleet of 2,443 F-35 fighters over the next 50 years. $1 trillion just to operate them. It has nothing to do with you know, the purchase of them, which was a ton of money, but it's going to be $1 trillion. And I was thinking about this and go, you know, at some point, don't you go $1 trillion? Couldn't we use that in a better way? And I know my right wing friends, well, you know, they keep us safe. No, not necessarily. I mean, it's part of our military system, but you think of how much money we spend, how much money we've spent over the years, how much of the Social Security trust fund we just fretted away. I mean, really, stop and think of how much we have spent on the military industrial complex. And, you know, Eisenhower's given credit for, you know, for bringing that up and for coining the term. But, you know, it was even before him. $1 trillion. And you look at the state of Pennsylvania, gotten $1 billion from education last year, more this year. And this whole, I mean, are we just that simple-minded that we can't think complex problems anymore? You know, Newt Gingrich said something that, you know, kind of, he was throwing a shot at Romney, and it kind of made me think. Here's the shot he threw at Romney.
Romney was the kind of guy who would have fired Christopher Columbus. Well, you either believe that we have vision, you know, Lincoln had a vision of a transcontinental railroad. The Wright brothers had a vision that they could fly. Edison had a vision that we could have electric lights. This has been a country of visionaries. Henry Ford had this vision you could build a low-cost car with mass production. We've been a nation of visionaries. And while the cynics and the, quote, realists ridicule vision, I believe in the Bible. Without vision, the people perish.
And you know what? I actually agree with him, you know, on that point. He didn't read the rest of the Bible that, you know, talks about adultery, but that's okay. You know, you look at this and you go, he's right. Lincoln, railroad. Wright brothers, airplanes. Edison, the lights, sure. Absolutely, get it. Why don't we have that kind of vision now? We understand gas prices going through the roof, yet we can't get a public transportation system off the ground. We can't get high-speed rail. We got the technology. We can't get off oil. We've got the technology. We could put solar panels everywhere. We could put wind turbines up. We could develop alternatives. We're not. Why? No vision. And you know why we don't have vision? Because people like Gingrich and people like the rest of the GOME, It's all about the me. And I look at this election. This is a critical time in our nation. I'm looking at this as 1980 all over again. We've got a choice this November. Do we return to the? Do we continue going backward, as the Republicans want to take us backward? Whether it's women's rights, whether it's workers' rights, whether it's energy policy, whether it's education, all of this stuff, back to the 1890s. Or do we want to continue on a path forward where we're going to say, you know what, make a common sense choice here. We need to get off the oil. We need to figure out how to use less of it. We're never going to do away with using it, but we need to use less of it. As a nation, how are we going to become energy independent? How are we as a nation to remain the superpower, a superpower? How are we going to fuel that? How are we going to power that? And I'm telling you, cutting education funding, not the way to do it. The next scientist who may have created the next whatever is going to not get the funding to be able to go to school. And the person who, where's the vision? I agree with them. We need to have vision. And I've been saying for the longest time, we need to have a Manhattan-like project to get us into the 21st century energy-wise, into the 21st century transportation-wise. But we're not. We're sticking with good old 19th century technology. Because it's profitable for a few. The few who have the funds to fund campaigns. You know, I look at Sheldon Adelson, the guy who's bankrolling Gingrich. You know, and it just blew my mind when I saw the numbers. At the beginning of the Obama administration, he was worth $4 billion. Right now, he's worth $25 billion. And he's out there pushing people who are saying, Obama, screw the economy up. And there's part of me that goes, you know what? Maybe he's right. Maybe Obama is screwing up the economy. How did this one guy get $21 billion of the pie while there are people who can't feed their kids? Maybe that's a question we should be talking about. Maybe that's the big vision that we should be thinking about. How do you have an economy that works for everybody, not just the handful? And, you know, education was supposed to be it. That was supposed to be the direction we were going. Yet, you know, more and more we keep seeing these so-called charter schools popping up, like the Life Force Arts and Technology Academy, that may have had a computer that worked, paying these charlatans, these shysters. Oh, I'm sorry, no, they're management consulting firms. You know, I've always wondered what a consultant does. Are you responsible for anything? And the answer is no. But, you know, I look at the story in Tampa, and you should really look this up. You should read the story, Life Force Arts and Technology Academy, or just look up Dr. Hanan Islam. There's another. Oh, man. Parents, the school is struggling. Will you go into this abandoned building and rip out all the copper pipes so we can sell it, so we can maybe heat the building? So I can teach your children Scientology? This is where we're going, folks. You know, this isn't a nice, I'm sure there are more cases. We just have to find them. Because understand, those charter schools, while some of them are private, some of them are public, some of them are private. And good luck. Good luck figuring it out. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
For and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Earth, sky.
Today, how a team of astronomers made a better yardstick for measuring distances across space. Astronomer Fritz Benedict of the University of Texas and his team have directly measured distances to five variable stars called R.R. Lyrae stars.
Up until our work, though, we'd had no really good measure of the intrinsic brightness of this kind of star.
Benedict's team used a very precise instrument aboard the Hubble Space Telescope combined with an old technique for measuring star distances called stellar parallax.
And basically, parallax is very easy to understand. You just hold a finger up in front of your nose and open and shut your eyes and alternate. You watch your finger bounce back and forth against the background. And the further away your finger is, the less of a bounce back and forth there is.
Knowing the distances to R.R. Lyrae variable stars is important because these stars are one of the stepping stones used by astronomers to estimate distances across the universe.
So the work is basically the moral equivalent of someone handing you a yardstick and you don't know if it's 30 inches long or 40 inches long. Now we've handed you a yardstick that it's either 35 inches long or 37 inches long. And that's a much better yardstick.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, how are you today?
I'm okay, thank you. How are you?
I am fantastic.
Great.
So the president gave a big speech on the auto bailout?
He did give a big speech on the auto bailout to about 1,600 UAW members at their big convention in Washington, D.C., today, the day of the Republican primary in Michigan, which is where, oh, that's where the auto bailout happened. Ha! Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Interesting how that happened. It was a really rousing populist speech, populist and popular, in which he took a number of shots at unnamed Republicans. Basically, he hammered home a contrast between him and the presidential candidates. He said, I place my bet on American workers, and I make that same bet again any day of the week, and now 3 years later that bet is paying off, and the workers are going 4 more years. Not just paying off for you, paying off for America. 3 years later, the American auto industry is back. And he also talked about somebody who wrote an op-ed column titled Let Detroit Go Bankrupt.
Yeah, I wonder who that was.
Yeah, I know. He talked about that. And he also talked about, he also played to the crowd, he referred to somebody's criticism of the federal bailout as a payback for unions, saying, really? Even by the standards of this town, that's a load of you-know-what. And he says, who knows, maybe the naysayers would finally come around and say that standing by American workers was the right thing to do. And he said, you know, they're talking about values a lot. And, you know, it's like, oh, okay. So this is a campaign speech. Because even though the front row at the briefing today kept on saying, well, wasn't it a campaign speech? Wasn't it a campaign speech? And Jay Carney was being coy. Clearly it was a campaign speech.
Sure,
there was nothing wrong with that. So he said, they're talking about values a lot. Well, these are values. And he starts fighting, you know, looking after your being a brother's keeper and doing this and doing that and all the hard work and fair play and all these other values that are not things that are being talked about on the other side.
Yeah, I mean,
it was a very rousing speech,
and I can't wait for him to hit the campaign trail and start giving more of those speeches, because I'm waiting for somebody to bring up the hypocrisy and the nonsense of the rhetoric on the right. I mean, every time you hear them talk about less government, less intrusive government, I see another state legislature coming up with something that is even more radical than they came up with yesterday.
Yes. Yes, you do.
I mean, if I were a woman, I cannot imagine there's a woman in this country that would vote for a Republican. Simply for the fact that, you know, every time I turn around, here in Pennsylvania, they're talking about an ultrasound bill. What?
They're not!
Yes, they are. They've actually proposed a Woman's Right to Know Act of 2012. So the insanity...
Don't they think we know why we're in the doctor's office? Don't they think we know?
No. No, you're not.
How stupid do they think we are?
Well, do you really want me to answer that?
I mean, don't they think we know what happens every month and the fact that it didn't happen, that meant that we got knocked up, that we're pregnant now, and that we might be going to have a baby, and so we went to the doctor's office?
No. You're sorry, Victoria. You know, I'm sorry. You can't possibly know. You don't have the intellectual capacity.
Of the intellectual capacity of a flea.
Well, that's what they think. And that's why I'm saying I can't imagine. But you know what bothers me is, you know, you look at these people who keep proposing this stuff, and it's all diversion. It's all the shiny thing in the room because they really don't know how to fix the economy. They don't know what to do other than keep proposing the same failed policies of the past. So they need to throw this stuff out there to keep us talking about that stuff instead of what's really important.
And yet Santorum is now attacking the press.
Yeah.
Claiming that though the press won't talk about what I'm saying about the economy and jobs, and then he says something extraordinary, like, you know, Obama's from the planet Zircon, and he's surprised when the press covers that.
Oh, where's Zircon? Did I miss that?
No, I made that one up.
No, but, you know, and I think, and I said this earlier, I think Romney's right when he said, you know, I'm not going to set my hair on fire, and I'm not going to say the incendiary things that people like the other ones. He didn't say names, but he's clearly going after Santorum because, I guess, on the right, the more crazy you are, the more outrageous your rhetoric, the more that they flock to you. It's kind of bizarre to me.
Right.
Just insane. In Ohio, there was a shooting yesterday. Three students killed, one still in the hospital. Are there being calls for more gun control laws, anything like that?
Well, Speaker John Boehner, who's from Ohio, had a press conference this afternoon, and he extended his sympathy to the families of the victims and then said, let's be honest, there are about 250 million guns in America, so they are out there, but people should use them responsibly.
Yeah, okay. As I said when it happened, again, I hope whoever the owner of the gun is held responsible, because I'm a firm believer in if it's your gun that killed somebody, I think you should be held responsible for something. How'd that?
Yeah, I don't know where that kid got the gun from.
Yeah, I mean... And the other part of it is the kid wasn't even from that school. He went to another school, and you know lawsuits are going to happen because the kid wasn't supposed to be there and ended up being.
Right.
So welcome to the litigious nature of our nation. The healthcare argument's coming up. Any chance of getting cameras in there?
Not in time. Now, there was a bill last month that cleared the Senate Judiciary Committee. And we talked about that, and I got some hosts quite excited about it, because this legislation has bounced around the House and Senate for 10 years now. And it gathered momentum last year when the High Court agreed to hear challenges to President Obama's health care reform law. And it is supported by some quite senior politicians, Nancy Pelosi, Dick Durbin, Chuck Grassley, Ted Poe, who's a Republican in Texas. Well, now it's stalled because even though it cleared the Senate Judiciary Committee, it hasn't been scheduled for a vote in the Senate. In the House, House leaders have been pretty mum about their plans. They've been skeptical of TV coverage in the past. John Boehner's House lawyers objected to televised coverage of a challenge to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And with regard to this Supreme Court bill, House leaders have referred questions to Judiciary Committee Chairman Lamar Smith of Texas, who has refused to answer any questions about his plans.
Well, I don't understand why you would have an objection to having a court TV or, you know, a court TV type channel, the Supreme Court channel that televises just like we do with C-SPAN. I happen to like C-SPAN.
I do too. Now, some Supreme Court justices have opinions. Let's see what they say. Justice Elena Kagan thinks it's terrific. Justice Sonia Sotomayor says she's had positive experiences with cameras. I don't know quite what that means. Justice Alito said that 3 years earlier he'd voted for coverage as a judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's expressed support. Roberts, in his confirmation, says, I don't have a set view, but I never know what that means with him. Then Clarence Thomas said in 2006, allowing cameras runs the risk of undermining the manner in which we consider the cases.
How would it do that? You mean making it maybe when we realize he has never asked really a question, that we would question the fact that he just shows up and doesn't participate?
And Antonin Scalia told an Aspen Institute forum in 2005 that 15-second takeouts on the network news would misinform the public rather than inform the public about the sorts of cases the High Court usually hears.
Well, there is I guess there's a case to be made for that, but I'm still a fan of Supreme Court TV. Make it C-SPAN 4 if you have to.
Yeah, make it C-SPAN 4. Why not? Yep. I know I'm editorializing now, but I don't see why they shouldn't be seen.
I'm right there with you, because I think that especially this healthcare law, I think this is something that I was really hoping that that we would get some coverage of. We're going to be in D.C. the Monday of the beginning of the hearings to cover that, and then we're coming back to Pennsylvania. But we're going to be out there for the first day of the hearings. I look forward to that. Thanks to the folks at Families USA who are sponsoring a talk radio Radio Row there. So good stuff. Finally, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs had some remarks on the Israel-Iran situation.
Yeah, he was testifying before the Senate Budget Committee, and he had to clarify some remarks that he's previously made in an interview to CNN. Basically, he told the Senate panel that he has not counseled Israel against attacking Iran. He said, we've had a conversation with them about time, the issue of time. So he's not telling Israel what to do. He also defended a comment that he's previously said that Iran is a rational actor. And that's been criticized by Republicans. And he says he doesn't mistake Iran's rhetoric for a lack of reason, and said that even Iran's actions that are unacceptable to the United States fit the country's pattern over the past 30 years.
Right.
We can't afford to underestimate our potential adversaries by writing them off as irrational, he said.
Yeah, I agree with him. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, part of me thought the saber rattling was simply to line their own pockets by spiking the price of oil, and like they had learned what we had done with North Korea. Every time they rattled the sabers, we gave them something. There was always some concessions, always some here. Be quiet for a while.
Right.
And there's part of me that thinks that's possible there as well.
Possible.
Anything is. As always, Victoria, it's great talking with you. I look forward to seeing you again tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
Talk Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down the machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant, blocking the only exit the Loyal Workers Club, Loyal Owners, only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the loving cup. Stood on the banks till the river rose up. I saw the bride in a wedding gown. I was in the house when the house burned down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. If you missed any of the interviews today, we talked with Laura Clausen from Daily Kos about the about Romney and what's going on, the assaults on education. This story in Tampa just has me just scratching my head. And as I told my wife, I go, what would you do if our school said, Mrs. Smith, the school needs a little help. Please get some work gloves and show up to this abandoned building and help us tear out all the copper pipe so that we can recycle the scrap metal and the, you'd probably pull your kid out of that school, wouldn't you? Absolutely. Just amazing. We also talked with Joan Fitzgerald, president of America Votes. She was here talking about the insanity that has become the GOP nomination process and really just the nonsense going on, the assault on women, the assault on workers. The more they keep talking, the more I'm kind of feeling good about this year. Maybe the Democrats might even possibly keep the Senate and take the House back. That would be something. Because I think they've shown the American people, they're just nuts. When you give them a little bit of power, look at what they've done. Look at the insanity that they have brought. And have they done anything towards moving us towards creating more jobs? No. I got the pledge here on my desk. November 2010, the election was a referendum. They said on jobs. We're going to be jobs, jobs, jobs. Laser-like focus on jobs. Yet all I see is insanity. All I see is cut, cut, and punish. We also talked with Dr. Chase Kadrevi, a professor at Slippery Rock University and president of the local chapter of APSCUF, about the massive budget cuts by our governor. And like she said, look, these are moral choices. We're making the choice between tax breaks for corporations, for loopholes for corporations to wash their money through, and the education of our future. And I'm telling you, I think it's at our detriment. The more money that we hand to these big corporations, the more money that we give away to the wealth class, the less opportunity our kids are going to have. And on a state level, if you defund education as we've been doing, you're going to lose industry, and nobody's going to come here. No one's going to want to come to the Mississippi of the Northeast. Not going to happen. So it's just short-sighted and dumb. We also talk with Tim Sharrock, author of Spies for Hire. He's also a journalist who covers private intelligence issues. We talked about the WikiLeaks situation. And look, at the end of it, my concern is privatization across the board. We have been hammered with this idea that, you know what? We privatize things. It's better. We get better service, better, better value for. And I go, where? Show me. Give me an example of where we've privatized something and it's actually worked to our benefit. Where it's worked to the benefit of, it's worked to the benefit of the huge companies that get these contracts. It's worked to the benefit of the people who are stuffing their pockets. That's who's benefiting from it. Not you and me. Definitely not you and me. You look at GE. GE, one of the big, they're a big defense contractor. Understand that. And you look at the we're told, anyway, that, we need these big corporations, we need to give them incentives to keep them. Over the last 10 years, now understand, last night I watched C-SPAN for a bit. We have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. Highest tax rate in the world. for the last 10 years, General Electric's tax rate, what they paid, 2.3%. 2.3%. In 2010, for every dollar that they made in profit, this is just mind-blowing. For every dollar in profit that they made, we gave them over 64 cents. So every dollar we gave them, they made, we gave them 64 cents. They didn't pay us anything. We paid them. Absolutely insane. This whole privatization thing, just absolutely nuts. Anyway, let's go to the phones. Got Andy on line one. How are you doing tonight, Andy?
I'm fine. How about yourself, Rick?
Oh, I'm this privatization thing is just making me nuts. I just don't see how it's done us any good, us, meaning you and me and other working people. I know how the Romneys of the world and the investor class of the world, how it's worked out for them, but it's screwing me.
Well, when you hear the term privatization, you got to run for the hills. Because, like you said, all that means is making profits for the corporations who are going to privatize and taking the whatever the institution is out of the hands of the public, so we have no control over it any longer. And now the corporations have control, and what do they do with the money they get from that corporate entity? They just give it back to the politicians, and they create another funding source for the backsheesh that the politicians get, so we never get our commons back again. Privatization is just the worst. There's no question about it.
And the next target is education. And I don't know if you saw that story in Tampa Bay where the charter school there, just mind-blowing. Hey, Andy, I know our school is struggling. Would you do this? The principal calls you up and says, you know, we need some help. We need you to get some gloves out and pull some copper tubing out of this abandoned building so we can buy pencils and paper. Would you show up? Would you keep your kid there?
Oh, jeez. That's awful. This has been going on for years and years, and the problem is this is a bipartisan effort. It's all for the benefit of the hedge funds and to break the unions. Those are the two goals of the charter school movement.
Yeah, you look at the charter school there in Tampa Bay, $85 a day is what they paid the teachers.
Jeez.
That's
unbelievable.
The vision. That's the vision,
unbelievable.
My brother.
Yeah, it's to break the teachers' union. And it's a bipartisan plan. Arne Duncan, Mr. Obama's man, has been doing that in Chicago for years. It's a shame. These bipartisan efforts have got to stop. You know, too, you're talking about GE. Of course, you know, how can a company, tell me this, Rick, how does a company make $14 billion of profit in 2010, right? $14 billion in profit, and they get a tax benefit of $3.2 billion.
Yep.
That's what it was in 2010 for GE.
Yeah, for every dollar of profit they made, we gave them 64 cents.
You know, they like have an army of accountants and actuaries just looking for ways to get more tax breaks. So we give them money instead of them giving us money, you know, for our society and to better our common. It just kills me.
It just kills me. But here's the reality. You know, the reality is the right has just pounded this. We've got the highest corporate tax rate in the world, Andy. Highest corporate tax
God.
Rate.
And Obama is drinking the Kool-Aid, too. You know, with his tax plan for the corporations, he wants to lower that statutory rate from 35%. Look, I was an analyst. I've been an analyst for like 15 years. I have never seen a company pay 35% in corporate taxes, and that's counting state taxes and international taxes as well.
Yep.
I've never seen anybody pay 35%. They usually pay less than 30%, 28%, and that's counting state taxes and international taxes too. So it's a joke.
It's an absolute
joke. Studies have showed, and what this guy Alan Blinder Princeton has a study that shows all the corporations he looked at, like 1,000 of them, the average tax rate was 8%. Come on.
And that's too high.
Let's stop this baloney.
And I keep seeing, you know, 1986 coming around again. We're going to lower the rate, and Obama's going to be right there to do it because that's
right.
That's where he believes the country wants to go. And we're
right. It's a race to the bottom.
Absolutely.
And after he gets it to 28, then the next thing will be 21 or 22. You watch.
Absolutely.
That won't be good enough either.
Absolutely.
Watch.
You had wanted to talk about American Crystal Sugar. What was on your mind about that?
Yeah, isn't that the company that has locked out its employees? They've been on strike for months and months.
Yep.
All right, if you had a congressional candidate that was taking money from American Crystal Sugar, don't you think the unions shouldn't be funding that candidate?
Well, one would
Wouldn't
think.
That be, huh?
One would think. Who,
yeah, you
who
would
are they funding?
Think, huh?
Who are they funding?
California's 2nd Congressional District. There's a guy named Jared Huffman. He's got funding from the Carpenters and Joiners, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the Machinists in Aerospace, the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters, and he's also taken money from American Crystal Sugar. And he's taken money from Gallo, which is another really anti-union shop. And he's taken money from PG&E to the tune of $11,000 when he was in the state Senate, which is almost like one of the most corrupt corporations on the planet next to BP. You know, they killed like 8 people here in San Bruno, just a couple towns away from me, and blew up about 40 homes when the natural gas pipeline exploded, among many other things.
That's why we have got to get money out of politics, got to get it out completely, why we need publicly financed elections.
Your people, your union people, have to wake up, too, and support the progressive candidates and not give money to the corporate hacks, the party candidates in the Democratic Party. In California, too, Jared Huffman is the corporate Democratic candidate. Norman Solomon is the progressive candidate.
Now, I've got no pull. I got no pull with labor, the labor hierarchy. I'm a guy who believes wholeheartedly.
You're the labor man. Come on, Rick.
I believe wholeheartedly in the rights of workers. I believe wholeheartedly in people joining and forming unions. But when it comes to the hierarchy, you know, I can make my suggestions, but I don't have much pull. Andy, I do appreciate the comments. I got about a minute left. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right. Great show, Rick. Take care of yourself.
Thank you. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com is the best place to go. You can download our podcast there. And if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. And, of course, you can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. But, you know, but like I told Andy, you know, look, I believe in this stuff to my core. I believe that workers should have rights and should have the ability to join and form unions and to collectively bargain, whatever that may be. You know, I'm not gonna get into the inside workings of fighting with whatever they've got, but I believe this stuff, and I think labor is what is the great leveler could be that ability to level the playing field between us and the billionaire class. Anyway, have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy.